Okay. Today's date is April 16, 2010. This is Victor Cunicelli of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. The time is approximately 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I'm accompanied by Brad Bondi and Bruce McWilliams of the FCIC, and Tom Borgers of the FCIC is present by telephone. We're here for the interview of Scott McCleskey. Mr. McCleskey is a former employee of Moody's. We are at the FCIC for the interview of Mr. McCleskey today. The interview will be recorded with the consent of Mr. McCleskey. Could I get your verbal assent for the record?
Yes, that's fine.
Okay. When I finish up the preamble, I would ask that everybody states their full name and spells their last name for the record for the transcriptionist. In the way of background, Mr. McCleskey, the FCIC was established by statute and signed into law by the President. It's bipartisan and consists of 10 commissioners. It's charged with examining the causes of the financial crisis and collapse or near collapse of major domestic financial institutions. The commission is charged with composing a report of findings to the President and Congress by 15 December 2010. The commission may compel attendance and testimony of witnesses and production of records. I can provide a copy of the statute by which the commission was formed. If you so desire, I have a copy of it here today.
Won't be necessary.
Okay. Okay. Please be advised that the FCIC is an agency of the United States, and FCIC staff are federal employees under the aegis of 18 United States Code Section 1001, with which I'm sure you're quite familiar, being a past FBI agent.
I am, yes.
All right. I'll tell you what. At that, I'm done the preamble. Bruce, do you want to spell your name?
Bruce McWilliams, McWillians.
Brad Bondi, Bondi.
Cunicelli is Cunicelli. Mr. Borgers?
Tom Borgers, that's B as in boy, O-R-G-E-R-S.
And Mr. McCleskey?
Scott McCleskey, that's Scott with two T's. McCleskey, McCleskey.
Okay. I'm sure you're familiar with rules of engagement for a recorded interview, but if I could remind you, please let me or any of the personnel from the FCIC finish a question before you start responding so that gives us a clean transcript. Usually one of my tells, if I want to interrupt you, I'll usually put up a finger to interject with something to say, okay, finish your thought. I want to interject something. I don't do it too much. If you mention proper names, please remember to spell them.
Certainly.
As you go along. And I know we'll probably be talking some specific Moody's lingo. If you use an acronym, if the first time you used it, you could explain it, that sort of thing. I think that's about it. Would you do me a favor and just start us out with a bio? And why don't you start your bio from college, where you graduated college, your degree, and go from there.
Okay.
And if I could interrupt, for the record, we are joined by Greg Feldberg, F-E-L-D-B-E-R-G, of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission staff.
Right. Okay, so my bio. I graduated in 1984 from the College of William & Mary, the degree in government. Immediately upon my graduation, I was commissioned as an officer in the Army active duty and spent just under 4 years in the Army, first as in the combat engineers and then in military intelligence. Left in 1988. Later in 1988, I joined the FBI as a special agent. Was assigned to the Las Cruces, New Mexico resident agency. Was there until December of 1990, and then the following month I started to work as a stockbroker, a financial consultant, they called it, at Merrill Lynch. Stayed there for about a year and a half, and in September of 1992, I took a position with the National Association of Securities Dealers, NASD, in market surveillance, and in that capacity I was responsible for reviewing market activity, looking for indications of primarily market manipulations and where there was unusual activity, conducting an investigation that would include anything from requesting data and requesting documents to on-site examinations, interviews, very similar to the one that we're doing today, and ultimately determining if there was cause to believe that there was a violation of the NASD's rules, taking it to the disciplinary process with the ultimate goal of sanctions, either disciplinary action suspensions or terminations of the individual or of the firm, or fines. Just for the record, if we saw something that looked like it was a violation of federal law, we would refer it over to the SEC. I did that for, I think, about 4.5 years. Left in 1997 and became a compliance officer for the securities subsidiary of Bank of America. It was called Bank America Securities. And I worked primarily with respect to rules as they apply to retail customers. I also worked in what was called the control room, which was basically responsible for monitoring employee trading. Like every other firm that I'm aware of, in the financial services industry, employees have to clear all their trades before, in this case, before even making them, through people in compliance, in this case in the control room, so we can make sure that nobody with access to material non-public information was trying to trade on it. And that's significant for some of the things I did in Moody's. I was there for only about a year, and I got an offer to go work in Europe. So I went to Brussels and became the vice president responsible for market surveillance at a pan-European stock exchange called EASDAC, E-A-S-D-A-Q. I was there about 2 years. Towards the end, I took on additionally the role of creating a new department specifically for investigations and enforcement on the back of some market activity that we had detected on the EASDAC market. After about 2 years, in 2000, so I took that job, I should say, in March of 1998. April 2000, I went to London to work in a similar capacity for a small stock exchange called TradePoint. About 6 months later, TradePoint was bought by the Swiss Stock Exchange and renamed Vertex. The Vertex was actually the fourth largest stock exchange in Europe because the Swiss bought it in order to move their blue chip equities trading out of Europe and into the European Union. So this was actually the home market for the Swiss blue chip securities. And I was there from 2000 until 2004, at which point, well, I should back up and just point out one thing, is that one of once it became Vertex, I took on a slightly different role. I was no longer doing market surveillance, but I was involved in regulatory policy. A lot of that meant dealing with the revision of financial regulation in the European Union, which was going on at that time. I sat on several EU-wide committees that looked at proposed regulations and looked at how things were being done on the markets. That led to me returning to the NASD in 2004. My role was head of the Europe office for NASD International. NASD International is primarily involved, or at the time was primarily involved, in consulting services to other stock exchanges, regulators, and what have you. So I was the senior director for Europe for the NASD. As I say, primarily working with consulting for other regulators, for exchanges, and a little bit of development of a master's degree course in England. So that takes us to 2006. I'd been in Europe for 8 years. I was married, and my wife and I were expecting a child, so we decided it was time to come back to America. Got in touch various headhunters, and after a short period, Moody's expressed an interest in hiring me. and I'm sure we'll go into the specifics in your questioning, but I was offered the position of Senior Vice President Compliance at Moody's, and I took that role in 2006. At this point, I'd be hard-pressed to remember the exact date, but it was roughly around April, May, June of 2006. And that was a new role meant to create a separate compliance department. At that point, compliance and regulatory affairs, meaning basically lobbying and public policy, were being done under the same individual named Farisa, F as in Foxtrot, A-R-I-S-A, last name Zarin, Z as in zebra, A-R-I-N as in November. And she spun off compliance into a separate department for me to head up, and she retained the regulatory affairs position. So that was the position I started in 2006. Early September 2008, my employment there was terminated. Unemployed for approximately 7 months, and then took on my current position, which is managing editor for North America for a firm called Complinet, C-O-M as in Mike, P as in Papa, L-I, N as in November, E-T as in Tango, which provides news and analysis for virtually anybody interested in financial regulation, primarily compliance officers, regulators, and others in the industry, but not exclusively. And it also provides I guess what we call IT solutions, things that gather together the compliance data that people need and help with the workflow. So that brings us up to today.
Great. If I could circle back a little bit.
Sure.
You arrive at Moody's 2006, and the senior vice president job is being split out of another job.
That's right.
Did you have to create that position, more or less, or were there rules, policies, procedures that were already in practice there?
Very little. When I arrived, I inherited two individuals, two vice presidents, for the staff. As we'll discuss, the business was essentially split into two areas. One was structured finance, and one was called fundamental, which was basically everything other than structured finance. So that was financial institutions, corporate bonds, and the like. So I had one vice president who was the point of contact with the fundamental side, and one that was the point of contact with structured finance.
Who was the point of contact with structured finance?
A gentleman named Alex Dill, D as in Delta, I, L as in Lima, L as in Lima. He chose to go back to another part of the business about, I want to say, 2 months after I arrived.
Okay.
As far as I know, he's still there at Moody's.
Okay. He was replaced by someone?
I replaced him, yes. I recruited somebody. Yeah.
Okay.
Beyond that, there were one or two policies that were already in place that came under my purview. And the two that I'm thinking of specifically are the securities trading policy, which goes back to what I did at Bank of America. This is the policy that set forth what procedure, well, first of all, prohibited a ratings analyst or anybody else from trading while in possession of material non-public information that they garnered in the course of their business. And also set forth the procedures for ensuring that they weren't actually doing this, so you know, making them provide our copies of their account statements and things. Not a terribly workable document, but it was one that I inherited. The other document was the Code of Professional Conduct, which had already been established fundamentally to mirror a thing called the IOSCO code. IOSCO is the International Organization of Securities Commissions or Commissioners, IOSCO, and they had a voluntary code for credit rating agencies from 2004, December of 2004. The Code of Professional Conduct essentially took the bits of that voluntary code that Moody's felt applied to it and put them into an internal policy. And if you, that's going to be important for some of the things we talk about later. It says right in the early part of that code that the office responsible for its implementation and enforcement is the Office of Compliance.
Right.
So I inherited those two things. Beyond that, I did need to build out the department. I needed to determine what positions we needed to create and then recruit to fill them, what policies we needed to establish, what procedures. So other than having inheriting two staff members and having a couple of existing policies transferred over to my purview, everything else was a blank sheet of paper.
Okay. And were you more or less an independent compliance department, or were you beholden in some way to the other parts of Moody, the business line?
That's a difficult one to answer. I would... My instinct is to say I was more independent then than I was when my reporting chain changed in 2007. The way that my reporting chain worked, I reported to an executive vice president named Jean Deering, J as in Julia, E-A-N-N as in November, E, Deering, D as in Delta, E-R-I-N-G. Jean Deering was the executive vice president responsible for three departments: compliance under me, regulatory affairs under Farisa Zarin, and for some time also the IT department, which eventually was made independent.
Did but Jean Deering report directly to the board?
She reported directly to Ray McDaniel, the CEO and chairman of the board. So so that was my reporting line. The reporting line did not obviously go through the heads of either of the business units. Was I fully independent? I would say largely yes, but not in the same manner as, for instance, an independent auditor who reports directly to the board.
The two people you replaced, I mean, what was the framework for the 100 years of Moody's, you know, before they decided to create this department?
Well,
must have had some kind of compliance.
Well, there are different types of compliance. I mean, to the extent that they had compliance responsibilities, they were a publicly traded company and had been at that point for about 6 years. Mm-hmm. So things like Sarbanes-Oxley, those bits, or HR compliance, accounting, those were done by existing, you know, the legal department or HR, what have you. Beyond that, Moody's was registered as, I guess, under the 40 Act, the Investment Advisors Act. At the time, the NRSROs, Nationally Recognized Statistical Rating Organizations, I believe were required to, but at any rate, were registered under the 40 Act, but it meant filling out the information at the top of the page, then checking the box that said I'm an NRSRO, skipping to the bottom and signing it. There were no substantial requirements other than filing every year. Beyond that, there was the IOSCO code, but that was voluntary.
And that was only established in 2004?
December 2004.
Was there an audit, independent audit function?
There was an audit department, yeah.
Okay. And was that effective and independent?
In my view, no. one of the things that in my early days, I'll start this by saying that I've always felt, particularly in contrast to my later days when I had a different reporting chain, in the early days, generally speaking, I felt fairly well in the loop. But one thing I do recall hearing over and over again was criticism of the head of internal audit for documenting too much. That in the course of his audits, they would come to the board or to various people, and they followed the normal audit format as I'm familiar with it. It would say, you know, here are the things that we found, and, you know, the controls are adequate or they're not adequate. And in some cases, I can't tell you having a couple of years distance between the situation. I can't recall specifically anything said this is inadequate controls, but there were some things that were pointed out that were critical of what was going on. And I do recall a lot of criticism specifically of the fact that he was writing this stuff down. And that became important the way that things went for me later on. And one day the head of internal audit, and I'll give you his name shortly, was gone. And the general conversation about it that I recall at this point was, well, it was no surprise because he was not backing down. His name was Charles, goes by Chuck, Windenecht. That's W-I, N as in November, D as in Delta, E, K, N as in November, E, C, H, T as in Tango.
Did you find that this attitude of don't write it down permeated Moody's business, or was it just with respect to audit?
Well, it certainly became true with respect to compliance. I think that they were most concerned about the control functions, but I would have to say, I'm trying to think of any specific instance, but my feeling is that it was absolutely understood within the organization, and particularly with respect to emails. In fact, the head of Fundamental, Chris Murray, is a very blunt-spoken individual, and I thought he was very good. He was somebody who really believed in compliance. And he would sometimes put out emails that were pretty blunt. And I still remember hearing people at a senior level rolling their eyes and saying, somebody's got to tell Chris not to put stuff this way. They weren't saying, in those conversations, he shouldn't say anything, but they were saying he's putting it too starkly. And the message that I was getting explicitly and implicitly was, you don't want to put something in writing that could haunt us in litigation.
Okay. Okay. Mr. Murray, was he one of the direct reports to you?
No, Mr. Murray. No, okay. Mr. Murray was a direct report to Ray McDaniel. He headed the entire Fundamental business. He was an executive vice president.
Okay. Getting back to, you had two direct reports, and one
yes.
was over structured products.
Yeah.
What kind of things, as far as compliance, did that gentleman report to you as far as structured products?
Right. Well, because it was very early before he left, primarily it was things that related to the two existing policies. And on a day-to-day basis, that tended to be securities trading matters. When you're dealing with rating agencies, it's a lot less straightforward about who is exposed to what information than in a securities firm. So a lot of questions came up that needed interpretation. And as I said, it was a poorly written policy as well. So I recall a few things along those lines, maybe one or two questions about potential conflicts of interest. One thing that was that did not come up, and I should point out, that was not within the compliance department's purview, was the models themselves, whether this model is accurate or not. That was more for the credit policy people.
Okay.
However, if there was a case that a rating committee had been held in a way contrary to the code of professional conduct, that would have been my business. And so if, for instance, let's say a rating committee chair had overridden the votes of the entire committee and said, nope, you're all saying AA, but I say AAA, that would be something for me to handle. For the record, I did not have something quite that blatant come up. But, Alex Dill, it was generally routine matters before
okay.
he left.
Circling back a moment, you mentioned conflicts of interest. And by conflicts of interest there, did you mean an individual was conflicted in their day-to-day tasking, or did you mean conflicts of interest as they related to Moody's and their business practices?
Well, with specific reference to Alex Dill, the former individuals, issues about the business would generally have been more something for me to take up than my direct reports, and it became more and more of an issue as things transpired. But in the early days when Alex Dill was still there, it was his individual conflicts.
Okay, why don't we get into that where I guess more and more you're seeing some of this potential conflict of interest for the greater organization.
Right, okay. Well, really, the event that sticks in my mind as the beginning of it, but it probably wasn't, you know, ground zero, was, I want to say this would have been, I may be off by a good 6 months on this, but I want to say early 2007, when Gene Deering, my superior, informed me that there was a group that was meeting on a confidential basis to talk about restructuring Moody's Corporation, and that she was on the committee. And I told her that if we're talking about reorganizing and there will be parts of the business that are dealing with commercial aspects, parts that deal with the ratings business, and the thrust of it was that this was what was going on, some sort of separation of the two, that I should be involved not simply because I was responsible for compliance, but because as an experienced compliance officer, I could take a look at the organization and say, you're going to have problems with sharing information, or we're going to need to set up what are called in the industry Chinese walls, information barriers here, here, and here, and that it would be far better to bring me in while it was being discussed than afterwards. Her initial reaction was that it was not necessary for me to be involved because she was. I brought it up again a second time a few weeks later, and I actually brought it up again a third time, not with her, but with Brian Clarkson and Noel Kernan. Brian Clarkson, C-L-A-R-C-K-S-O-N, at the time was head of structured finance. Noel Kernan was somebody who reported directly to Brian. I don't remember precisely what his remit was. They're both gone now.
How do you spell Kernan?
Oh, sorry. K-I-R-N as in November, O-N as in November. I don't remember what the meeting with those two gentlemen was about, but in the course of it, I do remember what it was about. We were in the process of moving Moody's from one building to another, and that meant trying to decide where people were going to sit. And I had raised the issue with them that they could no longer have people that were involved in sales sitting right amongst the rating staff, that was a conflict, that you needed to separate these two, and my point of reference, although I was not trying to replicate it, was the global settlement that came out a few years earlier with respect to separating research analysts from salespeople, that it was pretty clear that the regulators expected no commercial pressure to be placed on people that are giving objective analysis. And so as we were going through the seating plan for the new building, they got wind of the fact that I was saying, no, those people have to be on a different floor, called me into their office. And in the course of it, I said, I'm trying to deal with a situation here where I don't have all the information. And I said that I have brought this up with Gene Deering that I ought to be involved in the meeting. Brian Clarkson was sitting behind his desk. I was at a conference table with Noel Kernan. Brian said, well, I'll talk to Ray. And he said he had to call Ray about something else, I think. So while he's on the phone, I'm continuing to talk to Noel, so I can't hear what Brian's saying. But when he hangs up, he said, yeah, I talked to Ray, and Ray said no. And just having dealt with Brian Clarkson before, my suspicion all along was he didn't mention it at all, but it was to, you know, tell me that the matter had been decided. So at any rate, that was the beginning of me getting involved in conflicts of interest at the organizational level. And really, a lot of what it came down to was ratings business versus the commercial business. And in fact, we pursuant to the IOSCO code, we even had to decide which of our services, the many services that Moody's Corporation, not just Moody's Investor Service,
right,
the rating agency provided, which are rating services, which are non-rating services, and which are something in the middle that was never defined for us, called an auxiliary service, or sorry, ancillary service.
Let me ask you, you're familiar with the various lawsuits that some of the attorneys general have lodged against Moody's?
At a high level, I am, yeah.
Okay, and you know what they concern, the potential conflict in Moody's with...
Yeah.
Okay.
The issuer pays model, I think.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Were you familiar with the inherent conflicts that come with the issuer pays model during your time at Moody's?
Yes. And my view was that, and I have to say probably largely still is, there's no model you can come up with for a rating agency that does not involve a conflict of some sort. I mean, there are some, you know, make it a government agency, take it over. But beyond that, the investor pays model also has very large conflicts of interest as well. So given the way that the industry was structured, the best we could do was to address that conflict. Generally speaking, you want to eliminate conflicts where you can and where you can't. The regulators expect you to have some sort of effective means of addressing it. So that's where we were at Moody's, was this is the model.
Was it a part of your function to address that potential conflict?
It was never, as I recall, specifically stated. This is until the regulation came out. Regulation of the NRSROs, there's never anything that said among your remits is deal with the issuer pays model. Having said that, though, what I was responsible for were the controls that we had in place in the Code of Professional Conduct, which implemented the IOSCO code, and my understanding is that the IOSCO code had those concerns in there because they were concerned about the issuer pays model. So not directly, but the controls that we put in place,
okay,
I was responsible for.
Did you have occasion to, you know, to have to address that directly at any time?
Well, with respect to a specific problem where an issuer was putting pressure on Moody's,
and I'd even say where Moody's felt pressure, it didn't have to be direct pressure.
Right. I don't recall at this point ever having one brought to me. I do recall reading about them in the paper, and this was when, you know, later in my tenure, when part of the problem was I was reading about it in the paper and it wasn't being brought to me.
And just to the extent practical, I'm interested in your direct observations,
exactly,
day-to-day operations on the job, so I would appreciate what you could almost take it for granted that when I ask you a question, it's only as a Moody's insider, as a former employee, what you came,
right,
across in your day-to-day,
sure,
tasking.
Sure, and if there's anything that is not my direct knowledge, I'll tell you.
Okay, great.
So, I mean, just to finish off with that thought, the means by which I meant to address the broad conflict of interest policies was to take all the various aspects of separating out the various elements of the restructured organization and create what was called a separation policy. And that brought together a lot of different elements of separation. So there was physical separation, having people sitting on different floors if they were with different sides of the firewall, the Chinese wall, putting up walls in some cases. And I'll come back to an issue I was overridden on that point. IT security, so making sure that the commercial people didn't have access to the databases for the rating. So a lot of things that you have to do, put into a separation policy. And that was something that nobody had ever done before for a rating agency. Perhaps my colleagues at S&P or Fitch were doing it. But it meant that I had to start from a blank sheet of paper. And I mentioned the global settlement, where there was something similar that had to be arrived at with the investment banks, separating out conflicted commercial and research sides. And I went to great pains to say explicitly in meetings with the various affected heads of business, I'm not simply trying to take the global, the broker-dealer model and shoehorn a rating agency into it, that I'm taking the principles and what we can, since the regulators aren't telling us specifically what they want, and they never will, we have to divine it from what's out there. This is what we use for it, but we're not going to do everything that is necessarily required under the global settlement. But it took several months of back and forth. I wanted to get their input to see, you know, is there something that I'm missing, or do we need to do it a different way? And so there was a lot of back and forth. I was getting increasing resistance from the business side. They just didn't see why it was necessary to prohibit the two sides meeting together in a meeting. And some of the stuff, I got to admit, from somebody from an organization that's never been regulated, somebody who in their career has never been regulated, for me to say you can't go down the hall to go into that room, you've got to go through go the long way around, so you're not passing through that commercial area. You know, I can understand their reasoning, but I really found more and more that they simply did not want to. In fact, in some cases, I suspect they lied to me in order to avoid some of the things that I was saying that were going to be necessary. I mentioned one instance where I was overridden. Towards the end of Brian Clarkson's tenure, he was he got some bad press and he left in 2008, I believe. I had just gone to our Asia-Pacific offices, among other things, to address a number of compliance concerns, but one of the things was the physical security, the physical separation, I should say. And in Japan, they had no separation between the commercial and the ratings staff. And so I determined that a wall was going to be necessary. I cleared this through Michael Kanef, K-A-N as November, E-F, who at that point in time was my direct superior. A wall was erected with a locked door, required a key card to get through. And about a week, maybe 2 weeks later, Brian Clarkson, who by that point, we're talking 2008 now, was president of the rating agency, came through, and the email that I received and the phone call I received from my compliance officer in Tokyo said that the events transpired this way. Brian Clarkson said, "What is this wall? Under whose authority was it put up?" He was told it was compliance. And the quote, as related to me, was, "Well, I'm the president, and this wall comes down." Before that could happen, he was out the door. I think I heard from somebody not long ago, after my departure, that the wall's back up again. The wall stayed up. I think I've heard that it has come down again, but I have no direct knowledge of that.
Okay. And he was from Structured Products, but became president over the whole...
That's correct. Okay. And just to make it clear, because I put in a couple of different names there, it's probably a good point to explain the reorganization. I'd mentioned already a reorganization of the various departments under Moody's Corporation. When that happened, I think it was announced in mid-2007, Moody's Investor Service became the separate agency responsible. It was the NRSRO, responsible for ratings. Non-rating business and some of the ancillary businesses were put into something called Moody's Analytics. And there were a lot of in-betweens, very small organizations under Moody's Corporation as well. A lot of moving parts, people that had to talk with each other to get input for their new products and things, so it was very complicated. But Moody's Investor Service was the NRSRO, and Brian Clarkson was elevated to become president of MIS, Moody's Investor Service. Simultaneously, two people that I think any objective assessment would say were Brian Clarkson's rivals, the other two business heads that reported to Rhea McDaniel, retired. And the general feeling was they were pushed out. That was, I gave you the wrong name earlier. I said Chris Murray, didn't I? Chris Mahoney, M-A-H-O-N-E-Y, okay, was head of Fundamental, and he retired. And Chester Murray, M-U-R-R-A-Y, who was head of the international business, also retired.
You know, you bringing up a couple of names refreshes my memory. I was interested in knowing whether you kept up contact with any of these people.
I have had a few emails just in passing with, I think I had, I'm on LinkedIn,
right,
and I had a brief exchange where I invited Chester Murray to join my network, and one email each.
Okay.
Chris Mahoney, I have, quoted him in a book that I recently wrote. I had seen an op-ed, I think, that he wrote in Barron's, mm-hmm, wanted to use it, and I think at that point I was linked in with him, and I asked permission to quote him, and found out that he's got a blog, so we had an exchange of maybe a total of five emails just talking about blogs, but nothing about what had happened at Moody's.
Okay. What I'd like to do at some point is maybe just see if I can't get contact information for a few people.
Sure. Yeah. I don't think I have any of it on me, but right, yeah, we can make
okay
a list.
Yeah, we could always follow up, though.
Okay.
If I could, you know, contact you after.
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay.
Now, the other bit to point out, concurrent with this reorganization, most of the Chester and Chris, their retirement, and some of these other personnel changes did not take place in mid-2007, but rather late November, early December, mm-hmm, including changing my reporting lines. The third executive vice president that got pushed out was my boss, Gene Deering. Just to reiterate, I reported to Gene, and Gene reported to Rhea McDaniel. Under the new regime, there was an extra layer reporting. So essentially, the compliance function was pushed down even further from the top. My new boss was Michael Kanef, K-A-N as in November, E, F as in Foxtrot. And he had the same role as Gene Deering. So he was responsible for compliance, and he was responsible for regulatory affairs.
Was he in counsel or no?
No, he was structured finance.
Structured finance,
yeah.
Okay.
He reported to the general counsel, John Goggins, G-O-G-G-I-N-S, and John reported to Rhea McDaniel. So compliance now came under the purview of the general counsel with an extra, well, the extra layer was John Goggins now. Yes, Michael Kanef came from structured finance. He had no compliance background, and I was very concerned because while there is some merit to bringing people from the business lines, in some cases, into a compliance department and training them on compliance, you don't make somebody responsible for the oversight of the compliance department who has that background because they are conflicted. They're conflicted in two senses. One, if we're looking at the way things are done in structured finance, it's very likely that we're going to criticize the way things are done right now. And particularly if that person was a managing director in structured finance, as Michael Kanef was, he would have the authority to override me on anything that he had established. Now, to be fair, I don't recall any case where that actually happened, but the conflict is there, and that's why you don't do it. But also, it came to be generally assumed as more and more structured finance staff and managers were being put into completely different places, mostly actually in the control functions, in compliance, that they were being parked there. because by this point the structured finance business had just dropped off a cliff. There was nothing to rate. And so with the hope of a brighter day when they would need structured finance people again, this way they would be on hand. Now again, that was general rumor discussion. I didn't hear that was the actual plan. But as we'll discuss, a number of people from structured finance were put into compliance. And then if that's what's happening, then there is always the assumption, and I know that there were conversations where this was expressed, that one day they're going to go back to structured finance.
Right.
Now, if you're working in compliance, are you going to pick a fight with the person who could be your boss again?
Was there a natural tension between structured? It seems like structured finance got to be a bigger and bigger revenue producer for Moody's.
It was.
At some point, I guess more than 50% of their revenues coming in from these.
That's right.
Okay. Did you see that issuer pays model kind of warping what Moody's had historically been?
Well, I hadn't seen what Moody's had historically been before then. By the time that I came on board, the rise and dominance of structured finance under Brian Clarkson was in full swing.
Okay.
I'll give you an anecdote that just gives you a picture of Clarkson's attitude. Well, Clarkson was a bully, and anybody you talk to, and I didn't even work for the guy, so it's not just, you know, sour grapes. He was a bully, and very I guess the word that comes to mind is swagger. As part of my responsibility as compliance officer under Gene Deering, I was to report to the board once a year, and so once a year I'd have my report that had, you know, been reviewed and approved by everybody above me, but I would make this presentation to the board. So at the end of 2006, I had my day in the sun and I presented to the board. Nobody asked any questions, but there you had it. And so the bone they threw me as the junior guy, if you will, that got to present to the board was that I got to go to the dinner that night with the board and their wives and senior people from Moody's. So we're sitting in this restaurant, in a private area that's just the Moody's dinner, in a number of very large circular tables, maybe eight people at each one. And Brian, now this was after board meeting, so this meant that the results for the quarter had just been announced. And once again, structured finance was dominating.
So when was this?
This was November or December of 2006. So Brian Clarkson comes up to me in front of everybody at the table, including board members, and says literally, "How much revenue did compliance bring in this quarter?" Nothing. Nothing. And I'm thinking, does this guy think he's in a high school locker room? I mean, first of all, it's inappropriate in the first place and shows no knowledge of the compliance function. I was tempted to say, well, if I started fining you for the unreviewed trades that you haven't, you know, he was not big on compliance with internal policies. But at any rate, for him to say that in front of the board, that's just so telling of how he felt that he was bulletproof. And I'd love to say that he'd had too much to drink, but this was Brian Clarkson sober. So I just give this as an anecdote to show that this was the guy that was leading structured finance. For him, it was all about revenues.
Okay.
So to answer your question, I probably didn't see the fire, but I saw a lot of smoke. You know, that certainly the appointment of Brian Clarkson as head of MIS, when if you had asked me or anybody else, in my view, beforehand, which of the three people would rise to the next level, it would have been Chris Mahoney, because he had the institutional knowledge. He was Mr. Moody's for decades. For Brian Clarkson to be appointed the head of MIS clearly shows the focus of Ray McDaniel and presumably the board on structured finance as the revenue generator.
Okay.
Just before we move on, because I want to make sure that this gets brought up, and you're aware of it because it was in my testimony to Congress, within days, I even want to say the very next day after I was informed that I had this new chain of command, Michael Caniff came in and told me that two of my direct reports were being fired. These two were Scott Morrow, Scott with two T's, M as in Mike, A...
What? Two T's?
Yeah, two T's, C-O-T-T. Oh. Yeah, sorry. Morrow is spelled M as in Mike, A-U-R-O. He was the person that I replaced Alex Dill with, so he was responsible for compliance for structured finance. And Joe Alotto, A-L-O-T-T-O.
Were they removed for cause? Or
no.
Just?
Well, this is the thing. Joe probably had 30 years compliance experience and Scott 20, maybe 20 plus. Two of the most experienced compliance people I had. And they acted like compliance officers, which means that they would require people to meet the rules, and if not, they would say something about it. Now, I will say this. A couple of days, maybe let's say a week or less before all this happened, Scott Morrow had sent an email to somebody in structured finance, and I don't remember to whom it was sent, and I don't remember what it was about. But I do remember that it was very explicitly saying, you are not complying with one of our rules. And by the end of the day, I'd probably heard from two, three, four people at levels above me about this email, that they were not happy about it. But this is not something you fire anybody, especially a compliance officer, over. He was not wrong in his facts or in the need to document this. As I recall, it was something that had been building up.
Mr. McClensky, sure. We never really got to the procedures that you guys had in compliance. I mean, is there a formal report that if somebody sees something that's out of compliance, there's a formal report they write, or is it something as informal as an email?
In the beginning, it would be an email. But if there was something that was a direct violation, then the first thing we would do is email to stop it. And then we would institute, we had fairly flexible routes that we could follow, but it was usually some sort of disciplinary procedure. And we did employ that, in fact, I think at least three or four times with respect to violations of the securities trading policy. So that was the only reason that was alluded to, but not specifically mentioned, with respect to Scott Morrow. Joe Alotto, the reason that I was given was Michael Cano said, well, John Goggins says he doesn't know what Joe Alotto even does, and that he had asked some of the other attorneys in the general counsel's office who had sat in on one or two meetings, and they said, well, Joe doesn't really say anything. Now, John Goggins was three levels above Joe Alotto, couldn't pick him out of a lineup, nor could Michael Caniff. And I mentioned this. When Michael Caniff said that these two were going to be gone, the first thing I said was, why? And I got the, well, you know, we're not really happy about Scott's email, but they didn't say specifically that was the cause, because you cannot fire somebody for that. And with respect to Joe, well, nobody seems to know what he does. Well, I knew what he does, because I was an experienced compliance officer. Joe Alotto's responsibility was the equivalent of the control room. He was the person who actually was responsible for comparing trades versus the exposure to material non-public information. Virtually any technical violation would have gone through Joe, and Joe was responsible for establishing what we called, monitoring and controls.
I think you said that you were not sure what the underlying conflict was that, on Mr. Morrow's email.
That's correct, yeah.
Okay, you couldn't recall it?
I don't recall it, no.
Do you recall the approximate time frame?
Yes, it would have been December of 2007.
Okay.
maybe late November, because it was within days of Gene Deering's departure and Michael Caniff taking over.
And
it was the first thing he did.
And Mr. Alotto and Morrow, were they replaced with seasoned compliance officers?
Absolutely. No, they were not.
Was it somebody from structured finance who was brought in?
A structured finance analyst was brought in to replace Scott Morrow as the structured finance compliance officer. Joe Alotto's post for monitoring and surveillance or monitoring and controls remained vacant because that's a very specialized position, and I was recruiting for it. It was still vacant when I left in September of the following year. We did make an offer to somebody who backed out. So what I was left with was I lost about, let's say, 40 years combined compliance experience against my objection. Michael Caniff, I told Michael Caniff I wanted to talk to John Goggins about this, and Michael Caniff said, John's already made up his decision. I wouldn't talk to him if I were you. So there's nothing I could do about it. It took about a week to actually finalize their departure. But it was literally the first, Michael Caniff's first act was to get rid of those two people. Whether it was his idea that Goggins endorsed, or Goggins' idea that Michael Caniff executed, I'm not sure, but clearly they both had a hand in it. What I'm left with is not only losing a good 40 years of compliance experience, but somebody who was a junior-level analyst in structured finance was thrust upon me. Michael Caniff said, this is the person that's going to be filling that position. I had no say in the firing of the two people, and I did, in fact, strenuously object to it. I was overridden, and then I objected to putting the new person from structured finance in.
Over
structured finance, and it was overridden. He had a third conflict, not just...
Before you go on, why don't you explain your objection to having somebody from structured finance over structured finance?
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say. He actually had three conflicts. First of all, I'll give you his name, Joseph Grohotulski. That's G as in golf, R-O-H-O, T as in tango, O-L-S-K-I. He had three conflicts. The two that we mentioned before, which is he's coming from structured finance, and so he could be criticizing former colleagues, former bosses. And the second conflict is he could very well at some point go back to structured finance. And so whether or not that happens, the image is out there among people in the organization that he's going to take it easy on the people that he's supposed to be watching. Third conflict is that his brother still worked in structured finance. And, of course, he had absolutely zero compliance experience. I will say this to his credit, that after he'd been there for some time, he asked whether I would sign off on him getting some compliance training. But that by no means replaces the 25 years of compliance experience I already had. And I have to say that I was not impressed with his compliance common sense, compliance judgment when he came over. The reason Michael Caniff told me for bringing him over was he's a bull in the china shop. He will get things done. Now, I already had people who got things done without being a bull in the china shop, and all this guy did was break china. I remember riding in the elevator with him once or twice, at least twice, when Brian Clarkson got in. This would have been, I guess, before Brian actually left. And it was clear that from the banter between the two of them that Grotulski was close with Clarkson. Grotulski was also close with Caniff, having been pulled out of structured finance by Caniff to serve in this position. And that created problems, too, because over and over again, I found that Grotulski was going above me to do things and get them signed off by Caniff. Neither of these guys had any compliance experience, and both of them were coming from a structured finance background, and so I had to undo a lot of things that the two of them agreed.
Let me throw a few names past you. I want to see if you know them, if you, you know, managed to maintain contact with them. Mark Adelson.
I haven't maintained contact with him. I didn't have a great deal of contact while we were there. I'd have difficulty even remembering what his specific position was, but the name is familiar.
Okay. Arturo Cifuentes?
Don't know the name.
Okay. Okay. Mark Froba?
Another person that the name is very familiar to me, but I don't think I had a great deal of interaction with him.
Govind Gupta.
What was the first name?
Govind, G-O-V-I-N-D, and I'm breaking my own rule here. Yeah. Gupta is G-U-P-T-A.
Yeah.
No?
No, I think I the name's ringing a bell, but I think that's simply having seen his name after I left Moody's.
Okay. Gareth. G-A-R-E-T-H, Levington, L-E-V-I-N-G-T-O-N.
Don't know the name.
Okay. Pramila Gupta, P-R-A-M-I-L-A, Gupta, G-U-P-T-A.
I don't think I knew anybody with that surname while I was there.
And how about Tom Zita, Z-I-T-A?
I don't believe, I don't think I recognize the name.
No, go ahead.
For the record, this is Brad Bondi. Mr. McCluskey, just a few follow-up questions, if I may, on the email. Did you ever come to know who in Structured Finance was the recipient of Mr. Morrow's email?
I knew it at the time, but I've forgotten it since.
Oh, okay. Is that something, is there a document somewhere that might refresh your recollection? Do you have any notes at home or anything like that that might?
No, anything that I would have had would have been on the system at Compton, at Moody's, and so I don't have it. I will say this, I recall that part of the problem is that he, Scott Morrow, CC'd some senior people, and so they saw it. So there's an email out there somewhere in from him to somebody in late November, early December 2007, and that would be the email.
And do you recall who was CC?
I don't. I remember that they were, I think, managing director levels.
Were you copied on it?
Yes.
And with respect to the decision to remove Mr. Morrow, do you know if Mr. Clarkson was consulted on that decision?
I don't know.
And Mr. Alotto, you said he had a specific expertise.
Yes.
I don't understand if you could explain what sure. his specific expertise was.
Right. Part of what you need to do in compliance is not just to write the policies and the implementing procedures, but to document everything that you know that you are actually enforcing these policies and procedures. So you'll set up controls to test these things. And so as we were trying to develop, for instance, an email monitoring program, it took there are systems out there that will actually surveil email traffic in a fairly sophisticated way. And he was responsible for developing the procedures we would use to monitor them and how you handle any time an alert is generated. He would handle that to make sure that if there was, for instance, an email that caused concern, that it was addressed, that we tracked what had happened with it. Same thing with securities trading policy. So anytime there was an indication of a violation, your monitoring and control people will be responsible for designing a test to make sure that everything's being done, even routine administrative matters that involve compliance paperwork. So when we would get a new employee, we needed to make sure that they knew what the securities trading policy was, that they had signed it, that they had provided us with copies. They had set up a system by which we would get copies of their brokerage reports from their broker. Everything had to be done because if there was a gap, then we might miss something. He was responsible for setting up those procedures, those controls, helping me select the email monitoring system, which took over a year to actually get from the time that I had selected it. So he was gone before it was actually in place, but he helped to establish what the procedures would be. One of the things I remember that he recommended and I endorsed was that we would also be monitoring emails of the General Counsel's office, John Goggins, among others, which I think what he recommended was that those would be personally monitored by me as the CCO, the Chief Compliance Officer, not that some, you know, hourly wage clerk was going to see what was going on in the General Counsel's office, but we locked horns with the General Counsel's office over that particular issue. So so it's a very central role, and was going to grow into an even more central role as we got more and more of the electronic systems that, as we built out the department. So that's what his role was.
Did you monitor for specific conflicts or compliance issues, or was your monitoring more general, that if it was inappropriate conduct or foul language, or what were there limits to the to your monitoring?
Yeah, there were limits. In fact, one of the things that Joe Alotto had written into the policy was, we're not looking for foul language or HR issues, but here's what we do with them if we come across one. So it was specifically set up to monitor for two types of violations. Misuse of material non-public information, so an indication that somebody is sending an email that says, whatever, Blue Horseshoe loves Anacott Steel, for those of you who saw Wall Street, and conflicts of interest. So, for instance, an email from a salesperson to an analyst saying, we really need you to give a AAA rating to this Deutsche Bank security. We would be looking for something like that. So those were the parameters that Joe Alotto was writing into the policies and procedures.
Did you also monitor emails from Moody's employees to clients of Moody's at an investment bank, for instance?
Yeah, all emails into or out of Moody's. Now, I should say, this all supposes, this would all go into effect once our monitoring system had been bought and implemented. During the period that Joe was there, we still hadn't received that, so we had a fairly ad hoc system, and I'd have to think about how we did it. I think we had a fairly basic system of keyword monitoring.
When was the monitoring system put into place?
After my departure. I think I heard from some people that were still there that it was, well, no, I think we were actually beta testing it around the time that I left. It was just before my departure, actually. So I would say the summer or early autumn of 2008.
Were Moody's employees permitted to use instant messaging?
No. I think there was one group within Moody's Corporation that I think was allowed to use instant messaging, but nobody within Moody's Investor Service.
Was there an electronic block to instant messaging on computers?
I believe there was, yeah.
Okay. What about the use of personal email accounts? Was that prohibited?
Yes.
And was there an electronic block?
Yes.
So, for instance, an employee couldn't access his or her Yahoo or Hotmail account from his work computer?
That's correct.
And that was present during your entire tenure at Moody's?
I believe it was, yeah.
Do you know, was email stored and retained at Moody's?
Yes.
Are you familiar with the backup procedures for storing and maintaining email?
At a high level, generally, yes.
Do you know how far back email has been stored or retained at Moody's?
Until we implemented the NRSRO regulations, I believe it was 3 months. After Rule 17G, which implements the Credit Rating Agency Reform Act, went into effect in September of 2007. From that point forward, we were keeping them indefinitely. I think the record retention policy that we wrote specified 6 years. I think it varied from one geographic region to the other for legal reasons. But the effect was from late September 2007 forward, we were retaining them indefinitely.
Were phone records also kept and maintained?
Not to my knowledge. And there were no, to my knowledge, there were no recordings made or surveilled of phone conversations, just email.
Was voicemail run through an electronic system?
I don't know. It was the same type of voicemail that most people have in their offices. What the back end of that was, whether it was electronic or not, I don't know.
For instance, could employees receive their voicemail on a WAV file to their email account?
Not to my knowledge.
I'm good. Bruce?
Most of my questions. This is Bruce Williams. Should I come sit closer to the tape recorder, or does it matter?
I can.
It matters.
Why don't we? The microphone and I will move closer to you.
Most of my questions are just going to pertain to names.
Okay.
Try to discover who these people are.
Sure.
One question about that famous email we've been discussing.
Right.
Is there some kind of, let's see, you said originally it was emails that indicated conflicts of interest, or and then Vic asked you if there were specific forms that followed. I mean, is there some way we can identify that email that you're the, Scott will say, oh, this somebody right. violated, you know, policy number 666 or
right.
I think Brad pretty much, he narrowed the date range pretty well on that.
Okay, so we can find it. Let me ask you, there was an article in the paper the other day that highlights Chester Murray, head of the ad hoc committee.
That's right.
Do you know about this?
Yes, I was on that committee.
Okay. Met quarterly to advise the board on potential threats. Did that ever go anywhere, or that was the end of it when you left and he left?
End of what, I'm sorry?
Well, I mean, it says that the ad hoc committee quarterly to advise the board on potential threats.
Yeah.
After Murray left Moody's in 2007, the panel never met again. Did it meet before then very frequently?
Or? Yes, it met on a quarterly basis. This committee was, we called it the Risk Management Committee, I believe. And with the exception of two people who were kind of permanent risk management people, everybody on the committee was drawn from elsewhere in the organization. So there was, KPMG had come up with a list of 31 risks that needed to be monitored, 11 of which were key risks. And each of these was assigned to somebody whose responsibilities in the organization made them the logical person to handle that. So I had three myself. I think one was like risk that we get shut down because we failed to meet our compliance requirements. Very high level stuff. So we would meet once a quarter and we would have to report on our risks. We would do that in writing, and if it was one of the top 11, we would have to report verbally as well. So we met on a quarterly basis. Each of these risks got a rating, and as I recall, it followed the normal risk protocol of likelihood of occurrence and impact, I think. And if taken together, they rose above a certain threshold, that would specifically have to be reported in the next report to the board. And that report would, I believe, go from Chester Murray. Chester Murray was effectively the head of the committee, but I think on paper, Ray McDaniel, the CEO, was. I remember Ray actually coming to one of the meetings, but only one. Mm. Now, so to answer your question, it met on a quarterly basis up until the time Chester left, and then it didn't meet anymore.
So it issued a report once a quarter, basically.
Well, that's the question. If there was nothing that rose above that threshold, I don't know whether Chester still made a report, basically a negative report saying nothing to report, or whether there was nothing at all said. And the reason why that's important is that after Chester's gone, there's no more committee. Does the board know that this committee has been disbanded? And if they're not hearing anything, then it matters whether they were always hearing something every quarter or not. Because this is something that, in my view, the board ought to have been concerned about.
When did that start?
When did the committee start?
Yeah.
As I recall, the KPMG was engaged to review and recommend the risks that needed to be followed and how they were to be followed just before I arrived in the middle of 2006. So I believe that the meeting started probably around third quarter of 2006 after I got there.
So it lasted for a year and a quarter.
I can't say that for sure because I think there were some meetings before I showed up.
Okay. Do you know what the name of the committee was? Or do you have some way you can identify it?
I believe it was just called the Risk Management Committee.
Okay. I mean, the filing with the Connecticut AG.
Okay.
It seems like there's a few places in this. They mention analysts, so maybe you could help us sort of identify who they might be.
Okay.
This is for the record. This is the complaint filed by the state of Connecticut versus Moody's Corporation and Moody's Investment Services, dated March 10, 2010, in the Judicial District of Hartford. It is a lawsuit that has been filed by the state of Connecticut against Moody's.
For example, in 2007, during the course of a rating of a particular RMBS, a Moody's analyst reported to his superiors as follows: I received a call from the issuer. Our levels are off the other agencies at both the AAA and B2. We added 35 basis points to AAA to 2.25. It goes on. If Moody's managing director believes that adjustment of AAA is ill-founded, it goes on some details. Does that sound an analyst that you know?
No, I think there are other people that you'll probably talk to that were more. As chief compliance officer, I didn't get into a lot of detail or relationships below the managing director level. So a lot of the names and responsibilities you'd probably need to go to a different witness for.
Okay.
Would you have any suggestions for us who might be a good witness in that area?
One person that I know used to work in structured finance and he has eventually transferred out and also testified in Congress is Eric, E-R-I-C, Kolchinsky. K-O-L-C-H-I-N-S-K-Y.
Okay.
Also, with respect to not just the names, I think he'd know the names also, but also more specifically the procedures and the models, I would recommend you talk to Dr. Jerome Fons, F-O-N-S.
F-O-N-S. Have you maintained contact with Dr. Fons?
I have, yes.
Okay. And I know you said you don't have much of the contact information with you today. I'll follow up.
Right.
Okay.
Let's see. Moody Credit Policy Team asked one of its managing directors, who's been previously in charge of rating CDOs, about changing things. Does that ring any bells there?
I could
be on the credit policy team, who they would address a question
well,
to for managing director.
Well, each of the business lines, structured finance, public finance, fundamental, had a chief credit officer. And the chief credit officer for structured finance was Nicholas Vail, spelled W-E-I-L, and pronounced V-A-L-E.
Nicholas.
Yeah, Nicholas Vail. But I don't think that's who they're talking about because he wasn't a managing director.
Okay.
And chief credit officers had no management responsibilities. Excuse me.
Under the heading, Moody's punished employees who express dissenting views. September 2007, Moody's managing director expressed concern to his direct supervisor with respect to the underlying credit quality of many asset-backed ABS CDOs rated by Moody's. Suggests he noted the market data suggested severe downgrades. what comes to follow is this person was demoted and had a salary reduced. Additionally, he transferred from his existing position to a position in another unit within Moody's Structured Finance Department that was not budgeted at the managing director level. As a result, the managing director role within the company and concomitantly, his compensation were reduced. Does that sound
that sounds like Eric Kolchinski to me.
Okay.
Is the person who complained. And he was eventually fired from Moody's.
There's a reference here. The takeover of the Moody's compliance department by the Structured Finance Group culminated in 2008 when the previous head of the compliance department was fired and replaced by managing director. That's you, right?
Yeah, that's me. I know who that is. Okay. Yeah.
And who replaced you, sir?
Oh, that's a good point. David Teicher, T as in Tango, E-I-C-H-E-R. He came from the Structured Finance Department and had been responsible at one point for rating subprime mortgage securities. So to reinforce the point of the Connecticut AG, not only were two compliance officers fired, one replaced by an inexperienced structured finance officer, another position that I created to write policies for me, Michael Caniff put another structured finance person in. Michael Caniff came from structured finance, and as the final blow, I was replaced by managing director of structured finance, whose only acquaintance with regulation at that point was defending himself to the SEC for his role in residential mortgage-backed securities. Okay. I'm not the most objective source on this, though.
But were there any conflicts with Brian Clarkson? I mean, you sort of alluded to that when you're talking.
I'll give you another anecdote about Brian Clarkson. I read one day in the Wall Street Journal that an unnamed structured finance executive had gone among others. They were giving a litany of chummy relationships with issuers. One of them apparently had gone skydiving with issuers that were about to be rated by structured finance, and I read about that, and the next day there was, I had a few people in my office, I don't remember who they were, but I said, who the hell was stupid enough to go skydiving with a client? And I got a bunch of people looking at their shoes and nobody answered. I said, it was Clarkson, wasn't it? And they said, yeah, it was Clarkson. So conflict, yes, at that level. I don't have any personal knowledge of other conflicts. However,
when was that article? When was that?
Well, that was, I was going to say that was the one right before he resigned, but that may not be true. I would say it was sometime in late 2000s. I'd say probably early 2007. But you do trigger my thoughts on one other thing, and that was Noel Kernan. Noel Kernan became the head of structured finance when Brian Clarkson was promoted. Noel Kernan rose up one level. So he was structured finance.
What was the date on that, I'm sorry?
That would have been mid or late 2007. And he owned shares of J.P. Morgan. Now, I mentioned earlier that the securities trading policy, which governs employee trading, was poorly written. But it was written by the general counsel's office, people that, you know, basically they were corporate lawyers worried about litigation. They didn't have a background in compliance matters. And one of the things they said was, you just, you know, an analyst or an analyst manager can't own securities of an issuer. Well, that raised the question, and didn't answer it, of who is an issuer for a structured finance security. And because we were, I think I spent as long as I was there, I was trying to get agreement within the organization on who we should restrict, which companies ought to be restricted for structured finance. And I think I even remember, I can't say for sure, but I believe I remember Noel Kernan proposing no financial institutions at all. Let's just, you know, cover it with a big blanket. But he himself owned J.P. Morgan Securities. That was what was passed on to me. I didn't see it myself, but passed on to me either by Scott Morrow or by Joe Alotto. But we couldn't do anything about it because it wasn't clearly prohibited in the securities trading policy. But I do remember being informed that he owned J.P. Morgan Securities. So you asked about Ryan Clark's conflicts of interest. None that I'm aware of with Brian.
Yeah. Now, earlier you'd alluded to Mr. Clarkson and his compliance with respect to the securities trading procedures.
Yes.
Were there concerns that you had with respect to Mr. Clarkson's compliance with the securities trading procedures?
Yes, not to the extent that I believed him to be trading based on material non-public information, but from an administrative point of view, the way that this securities trading policy had been set up by the General Counsel's office, you did not, employees did not pre-approve trades. They didn't have to get clearance from compliance prior to trading, which is, I think, the predominant model. That was how it was at Bank of America. Before you traded, you had to get clearance. Excuse me. Instead, compliance department would get either electronically or in paper once a month account statements, and we'd also get trading confirmation so we could see what they were trading. And we would then put this in an electronic system and inform the manager, you have trades you need to review. Even I got these because, you know, some of my people own stocks. You would have to go in and say, and make the judgment, this person does or does not have access to material non-public information. The reason why it had to be done this way in a rating agency is sometimes people get involved in other rating committees are completely ad hoc. There are no standing committees. So you couldn't have a one list of this is what that person rates. So the long and short of it is that it became one of these administrative things that every manager had to do. And so you would get in, and you know, once a week you might have a list of 10 people, 10 trades. You had to go in and, you know, click a few boxes and approve it or disapprove it, and you could flag it as something that was of concern to you, in which case it would go to Joe Alotto, and he would work to resolve whether it was a conflict, and if so, what we had to do about it. Brian Clarkson and John Goggins were probably the two worst managers in terms of never going in and reviewing these things. And it got to the point where they'd get such a big backlog. I would tell my vice president, who ran my IT within compliance, to put it on an Excel sheet and have them go through everything. And so once every 3 months or whatever, we'd have to go to Brian Clarkson and have him get caught up. And my concern was not just the administrative bit. I mean, it's one thing to look at five trades with some scrutiny, but if you've got an Excel sheet, I really don't think he was giving it the same level of scrutiny that he should have. There's also the tone from the top issue. And this is a big issue for compliance officers and for examiners when they come through to examine. What is the message about compliance that is coming down from top management? And probably the best person at complying with all the things, whether it was taking training, signing a document, reviewing employee trades, was Ray McDaniel. The worst were probably people one level below him. John Goggins and Brian Clarkson really stick out as people that would just take forever to do any of this stuff. And that sends out a message. I mean, these are the same people. A third anecdote for you also involves Brian Clarkson. And I'm getting a little bit off track here, but I think that it's important with respect to the tone from the top. A few months before my arrival at Moody's, they had their year-end party. I don't remember if it was the whole corporation or just structured finance. So they had a party one evening. And there were pictures from it in the quarterly newsletter that came out. And one of them, you know, just as a courtesy to me, when I showed up at the job, there was a copy of the latest newsletter there. And there's a picture from the party of three of the most senior people from Structured Finance. Brian Clarkson, who eventually became president, Michael Caniff, who eventually was responsible for my department, as well as regulatory affairs, Noel Kernan, who became head of Structured Finance and was eventually forced out after there was a problem in the papers that I'll come back to. They're dressed as the Blues Brothers, and the caption said that they had just got done entertaining the assembled masses with their version of the compliance blues. In fact, this was, I think, mentioned in a story in the news later, and I think the spokesman for Moody's did as good a job as he could of trying to explain it away, but the point is, you just do not send that kind of message. You don't make light of compliance in a regulated firm. That's just sending the wrong message. So I bring this up because it goes to the same point as Brian Clarkson's failure to do the routine compliance administrative matters that even Ray McDaniel found time to do. It sends the wrong tone. You know, every reporter that's talked to me has asked for a copy of that, and I thought I saved a copy, but I tell you, I've looked everywhere. If it would be a poster in my house if I still had a copy, but I'm afraid I do not, for the record, have a copy.
What was that quarterly newsletter called?
The AAA, AAA.
And what was the date of the one describing the holiday party?
I don't know. I can tell you that it was evidently the most recent version when I started in May or so of 2006.
Now, Mr. McCluskey, in your letter to us, you mentioned that you were ultimately fired in September 2008.
That's right.
Can you describe the circumstances surrounding your termination?
Yes, it will be very brief because I walked in for my weekly meeting, regularly scheduled meeting with Michael Caniff, and he was there along with the person from HR that is there when people are being fired. And if you've ever seen the movie Goodfellas, where Joe Pesci goes into the motel room and he's been told he's going to be made a member of the family, and he sees the hitman there, that was my Joe Pesci moment. I knew exactly what was going to happen. And Michael Caniff had always told me, this is the same procedure he told me he used when firing Morrow and Bellotto, that you do not give a reason and you make it very brief. And he just told me, senior management has lost confidence in you. And I remember that he said, I think for the benefit of the other person in the room, I think he said something like along the lines of, as you know. And I didn't raise it at that point with him because he asked, do you have any questions? And I started to say something. I said, well, it doesn't really matter anyway, does it? And so he left the room for me to do the administrative things with the HR person. And I mentioned to her that not only had Michael Caniff never expressed any dissatisfaction with my performance, but about 2 weeks before, after the SEC had come through and done its sweep examination, which I had been excluded from, had no involvement in whatsoever, the SEC came out with their list, their deficiency letter, and I was given responsibility for addressing the deficiencies. As I said to the HR person, that was a very important thing for Moody's. I also was responsible for, at the same time, addressing some concerns related to our European operations. And it did not make sense to me that you hand something of such importance over to somebody you have no confidence in and then go on vacation for a week, as Michael Caniff did. You know, that either means that they didn't feel that the SEC examination was important, or that at least before he went on vacation, they did have confidence in me. But those are the circumstances. And then I was allowed to go back to my desk, put a few things in a box, and was escorted out of the building by the HR person. And my staff, I don't know whether they had arranged for them to be somewhere else. Nobody was there in the hallway. So first they knew about it was 1 hour later when they were called into the conference room and told that I was out and that David Teicher from Structured Finance was the new chief compliance officer.
Were you asked to sign any documents concerning your departure?
I was, yes.
What were you asked to sign?
One was a one-sheeter that basically said that I understood that I was not permitted to take out any confidential information and that I wasn't taking out any confidential information. The other was a severance agreement. I have a copy of it with me. The only thing I would ask, happy to provide a copy, but I'd like it to be redacted both with reference to my name, any personal information, and salary. I provided a document once to the Senate, to the House Committee, and they redacted it. What neither of us understood at the point was that when Google puts something up on a website, it doesn't recognize redacting, and it just pulls the first line off of this thing. And so my home address was on Google for quite some time. So, but having said that, happy to provide you a copy. I've got a copy here. I'll need the copy back, though. But yes, it's a restrictive severance agreement and release.
And does it include a non-disclosure agreement?
It does.
And could you point me to that non-disclosure?
It's been a while since I've looked at it, but well, there's several bits of it. One of the things, and again, I'll refer you to the document because I haven't looked at it in a while, but one of the things that I'm not allowed to disclose is the very existence of the, yeah, of the document. But also, I'm not the normal things not provide business secrets or whatever. But also, I'm not permitted to say anything negative to anybody about Moody's. I remember at one point somebody asked me, well, if it's true, you should still be able to say that. That should be okay. And that's not what it says in there. It doesn't say false bad things. Even if something is true and I say something bad to anybody, other than investigations, testimony under oath, then they could take legal action against me. I'm also, it's got basically a non-compete agreement, so I can't work for a competitor like Standard & Poor's or anybody who provides them services. And when you couple that with the fact that I'm not allowed to disclose the existence of the document itself, it put me in a very difficult position. I was talking with a consulting firm about a possible position, but how would I be able to determine whether they had any clients that were competitors without saying the reason why? I'm sorry, I can't work for you if you have... This particular firm, it turns out, had a contract with Standard & Poor's or was planning to have one. Now, if I'm going to say I can't work on that, I better be able to give a reason, but I can't. It's just one of the instances where, again, it's a poorly written document coming out of Moody's. It's self-contradictory in several places.
Mr. McCluskey, what sort of compensation did you receive as a result of your severance?
1 year salary.
Anything else?
Yeah, they paid for, I guess it's called outplacement, where I would go once a week or so to somebody who would help me find a job, but it was really rather useless. The job that I've got now and the offers that I got through other means I got through myself. But, to their credit, they this is the standard agreement that Moody's does. So they did it for everybody else. The duration of the salary continuous depended on your level. But even Joe Alotto and Scott Morrow would have gotten something like this, but I think maybe for 9 months rather than 12 months.
And going back in time, how were you compensated? Did you receive a salary and a bonus?
Salary and bonus and restricted stock and stock options.
Okay. And if I may ask, sir, what was your salary and bonus? And your
during your tenure?
It started around, I want to say, $262,000 was my salary. I got a bump, I think, of about 10%. The final salary will be there on the agreement. The bonus, I want to say, was in the neighborhood of $50,000 or so. I should remember at this point, but if I put it all behind me, I'd have to look at my records.
And that was $50,000 for 2006, and then 2007 you would have received that?
Yeah, I think it was lower in 2000. I think everybody's was lower in 2007. And as I say, I got stock options, which priced at 72, and Moody stock hasn't seen 72 since the day they priced it. It's not even been half that in years, and restricted stock. And some of my restricted stock did vest prior to my departure.
How was your bonus calculated? What was the metrics that applied?
There weren't really metrics. It was based on a performance evaluation, and then assuming that I met my goals in the performance evaluation, there was also an element of it based on Moody's achieving its revenue goals. So that was kind of a multiplier. So it might go up. You might get, assuming that you had gotten 100% of your goals, that's 100% of your target bonus, and then the multiplier might make that 114%, or it might make it 90%.
Who was responsible for your performance evaluations?
It was Gene Deering and then Michael Caniff.
And how often were you reviewed? Once a year?
Once a year.
And how were those reviews? What were the results of those reviews?
Good. I think the only... It's one of these things where, because I wrote them as well, you had to put in good and you had to put in, you know, things to develop as well. The only thing that I think you could remotely say was an area for development was that Gene Deering had said that I was, my strong suit, if you will, was providing advice and guidance to other senior managers, and project completion, she said some things had been delayed, which I had a discussion with her. I disputed this because usually it was her wanting 24 drafts of documents, but you know, every employee is going to say there's nothing wrong with me. But that was in the evaluation that I got just as she was leaving. And I will say this, that after that, nobody, whether it was Michael Caniff or John Goggins or anybody else, ever expressed any dissatisfaction with my ability to get projects done.
And are you familiar with how the business personnel were compensated?
It was also based on performance evaluations. More detailed than that would have been more the responsibility of my vice presidents that handled those various areas. I probably knew more in detail at the time, and it's just been 2 or 3 years since then, so I wouldn't feel comfortable speculating at this point.
Do you know if compliance or risk management were factors in a business person's compensation?
Generally, no. It depended on the business unit manager, and I believe there were a couple that did incorporate it. There are a lot of business unit managers at all levels at Moody's that actually take compliance very seriously, and a couple of them put that in there, and I know that I was pushing to have it put into everybody's. Everybody in the organization would have a component, and we actually had some discussions on how that would work. I don't know whether that ever was put into place, though.
Do you know if that was a component of structured finance products?
I don't know.
And the actual payment of your bonus based on your performance evaluation, who was responsible for that? Would that have been Ms. Deering and Mr. Caniff, or would that have been a higher level like the board of directors?
Approving the amount?
The amount. How did the amount get
right
calculated?
Well, it was calculated. Whether or not I met my PE factors would have been determined by my immediate superior, so Gene Deering and then Michael Caniff. Whether that had to be approved, I actually, you're right, I believe John Goggins weighed in on these, because as I recall, some of the calculations that I made for my staff were changed by John Goggins. Well, Michael Caine have said by John Goggins. And I remember very specifically Michael Caine's explanation for lowering some of my staff was that John was not happy with the fact that some of the compliance staff were making more money than some of the lawyers reporting to him in general counsel. I remember also that in 2008, Michael Caniff told me that I was not receiving a raise to the salary that year, and that the reason for that, John Goggins had said that nobody, let me back up for a second, that the determination had been made by senior management, unspecified who that is, that because of the tough times Moody's was going through, nobody at the managing director level or above would get a pay raise. And that John Goggins had made the determination that although I was a senior vice president, which is one level below managing director, I would be included in this group. I have absolutely no basis for this, but I have a strong feeling that some of the other people at my level or above that reported to John Goggins did get favorable treatment, did get pay rises. And it's just because there was a pattern of his favoring other people. So,
were you ever consulted with respect to compensation of anyone outside of the compliance group? In other words, anyone in the business lines or anyone else throughout the organization?
No.
Earlier you alluded to ratings committees.
Yes.
And it's a term we've heard. Can you just explain to us what a ratings committee did?
Sure. The business was set up, the easiest way to describe it is with respect to the fundamental group, and then I'll tell you how it differed with structured finance. Fundamental group, it was basically set up by industry. So you might have a group of individuals, a team, that was responsible for the U.S. Auto industry, let's say. There's only a handful in that industry, but they would be responsible for, as a group, for rating all the companies in that industry. And each individual issuer would be assigned to an analyst, and that analyst might have an associate analyst who helped them with research and running the models and things. Now, that assigned analyst would, whenever it was appropriate, research the bonds, either ones that are outstanding that were due for surveillance or a new issue, and come up with a recommendation based on methodologies and models that existed for that industry, and come up with what he thought that the rating ought to be. And it wasn't something where you just plug in and out spits the rating from the formula, because there were some qualitative factors involved. You know, do we think they have a lot of competition? Do we have confidence in management? So there was generally a range of acceptable outcomes, if you will. But the analyst would determine where in that range, how many notches, you know, that this ought to be, let's just say, a single A rating on this bond. Then they would have to present to a rating committee. And the rating committee would generally involve other people from the team, but not necessarily all of them. In fact, depending on the size of the team, it was rare that you would have everybody there. So in that sense, it was ad hoc. There might also be other people there. So for instance, if you've got the U.S. auto industry, there might be somebody from the steel industry to say, well, you know, they're going to have trouble resourcing domestic steel, and that might impact it, just as an example. So people from other committees might come over. And this is why you never knew exactly which companies an analyst was exposed to. So the analyst would make his presentation. There would be a rating committee chair, who was generally speaking a senior person, usually managing director. Size of the committee could vary. It could be just a few people. It could be 15, 20 people. After the presentation, it would be opened up for questions, and then there would be a vote, and the rating committee procedures which varied a little bit from place to place within the organization, generally said you vote from the junior most person to the senior most. And the reason for that is so that junior people aren't influenced by the votes and opinions of the senior people. The rating itself is there for a group decision. And I can't tell you how frequently it occurred that the analyst recommendation was not the final outcome, but it was certainly frequent enough that it didn't bat any eyes. You know, if somebody had said AAA and the committee voted three or four notches down below that, that might raise some alarm bells and somebody might report it as a some sort of problem. But that would have been very rare. The rating committee process is done this way as one of the controls against influence on the analysts themselves. Because if the analyst isn't the person who actually by themselves determines the rating, you know, then you can't say, well, this person, you know, had undue influence. So at any rate, that's how a rating committee works. We should come back at some point, also speaking about the conflict of interest issue, to the point about analysts and negotiating fees. We should make a reminder to do that. So that's how a rating committee works. It's completely ad hoc. Ratings could be appealed by an issuer, and there was a procedure for that, but it was very much restricted. It could only be used, for instance, if some very new and material development had occurred, like within the last hours or days, and maybe one or two other things where you just needed the flexibility to appeal.
And the process that you've described, would that also apply to structured finance products?
Yeah. The difference was more in the rating process than the committee. The rating process, and I would strongly recommend you talk to people like Eric Kolchinski who did this rather than take my view of it. But in fundamentally, you have an instrument. And you have a company, and here are the numbers, and you rate it. Structured finance, you've got a structure that it doesn't even have anything in it yet. The mortgages haven't even been bought, or the credit card receivables haven't been bought. But the structure is we will basically buy this many from Texas, this many from Florida, loan-to-value ratio, and there's about 40 different factors. And then the whole idea was the top tranche will be AAA. Otherwise, there's no point in doing it. And the tranches are basically where you stand in line to get paid. So if you're in the top tranche, you're first in line to get paid. Therefore, it's the most secure tranche. And as I understand it, the role of the analyst was to basically say, to rate the tranches. And if something was going to be AAA, it probably needed credit enhancement, and specific types of credit enhancement are things other people can tell you about, but it might include over collateralizing the loan, or perhaps, I don't know, mortgage insurance on the mortgages. And so to the extent that there might have been some iterative process there, it might have been Deutsche Bank comes and says, here's our structure and these are the characteristics of what would go into it, and Moody says top tranche is AA. And Deutsche Bank says, we'll come back to you, and comes back with more credit enhancement, and then Moody's says, that's AAA. So that's the difference in the process.
Now, in terms of a ABS CDO containing RMBS, residential mortgage-backed securities, a CDO meaning a collateralized debt obligation, if Acme Corporation has a CDO deal that it once rated, and it approaches Moody's, would there have been a relationship person at Moody's to whom Acme would approach? Was there a person assigned to each major investment bank that did CDOs?
I don't believe so. People that would have been closer to the situation can confirm. you had a managing director for various types. You had a managing director for the RMBS or for CMBS, commercial mortgage-backed securities. But I doubt that they would have been the first stop when somebody said, "Here." Clearly, if you're Agmi Corporation, you have to have somebody you pick up the phone and go to. But I don't know, and I don't believe that it was the case that Acme would have had, or any corporation would have had, a specific relationship manager, if you will.
And what were the was there a work product or a document generated by the ratings committee after it met?
Yes, the rating committee memo.
It was called a rating committee memo.
Yes.
And what happened after that rating committee memo was drafted?
Well, very quickly after the rating committee meets, the rating itself is disseminated publicly, and this was something that actually I instituted some procedures and made sure that this happened as quickly as possible, because my view, and I believe that the SEC's view also, was that a rating, especially a rating change, is material non-public information. In fact, 10 years before, when I was at Bank of America, if anything moved more than two notches, we considered that to be material non-public information that we had to, in the control room, we had to make sure nobody had been trading on it. So the point is that once the committee meets, the rating committee was entered electronically into a system that would spit it out to Bloomberg and the various news services. Shortly after that, but very quickly, the rating committee memo would be drafted by the ratings analyst, and it would include information which is now required by Rule 17G, which includes who was on the committee, I think what the vote was. I mean, all the things that you'll see in 17G would be part of that memo now. That's not a public document. That's not something we would share with the issuer or with the public.
For structured products like an RMBS CDO, were ratings ever communicated to the issuer or the underwriter prior to the rating being made public?
I'm 99% sure that the answer is yes, both for structured and for fundamental, because they would see the press release generally, which would have the rating, and it would also give them the opportunity to appeal. But the point was that this would be something where they're told this thing is going out like next 10 minutes. We were mostly looking for any comments on the press release, looking for anything there where there was a material misstatement of fact or disclosure of confidential information, because as part of the process, the company might have shared some confidential information with Moody's, and that would not include not just material non-public information, but something that isn't necessarily market moving but sensitive to the organization that they don't want their competitors to know. So in that would be the rating itself, and so they would see it a short time before. And the fact that I know that we had an appeals process tells me, yes, the answer must be that they were aware of it ahead of time.
Now, I've heard allegations that ratings committees would be convened, come up with a rating on a structured product like an RMBS CDO, tell the issuer or underwriter of that CDO the rating, and that issuer underwriter may have, in fact, pressed back on that rating, and that the rating committee was then reconvened and the rating was changed as a result of pressure by the issuer or underwriter. Do you know of any instances where that may have occurred?
I don't have any personal knowledge of something like that. There was something in the papers, which ultimately, this is, I think I'd alluded to Noel Kernan's departure. where I believe it was something, it was either pressure from the issuer or it might have been, there were two different instances, I can't keep them straight now. Another instance where it turned out that there was a problem with one of our models that would have required us to go out to the public and change a rating. One case or the other, the allegation was that somebody, and I was told by Michael Caniff that it was Noel Kernan, had overridden an entire committee and said, we will lose business if we do this, change the rating. And shortly after that, Noel Kernan did leave Moody's. It was not publicly disclosed why. There was a supposedly independent investigation conducted by Moody's into that incident. And I remember the press release that came out indicated that an unnamed employee had violated our code of professional conduct. And to me, this is getting towards the end of my time here. This was the smoking gun to me, and I was very strenuous in my objections to Michael Caniff. I had heard that something was going on, and I had said, I need to be involved in this. I don't know the details. I don't know what they're looking at. And he told me, I don't recall exactly what he said. I think that he used the same line he normally used, which is, we'll lose attorney-client privilege if we bring you into this. But when this thing comes out and it says violation of the Code of Professional Conduct, remember when we started, I said that the Code of Professional Conduct says the Office of Compliance is responsible for violations of this code. If Moody's was aware that there was, or even suspected that there was a violation of that code, as it turns out in the press release, then that was my responsibility.
Who was the issuer of that deal that Mr. Kernan allegedly violated the Code of Professional Conduct?
I don't remember.
Was it an RMBS CDO or was it Residential Mortgage-Backed Securities?
I don't remember.
Do you remember who conducted the independent investigation?
It was an outside law firm. It would be in the newspaper, but I don't know at this time off the top of my head.
Who inside Moody's directed that investigation?
Well, I believe it was John Goggins. Whether somebody above him directed him to do it, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. And approximately what time period did the alleged violation by Mr. Kernan take place?
Well, it was publicized in early 2008. And I believe that the occurrence was also early 2008.
Who else would have knowledge of this alleged occurrence other than Mr. Kernan himself?
Well, certainly Michael Caniff.
Mm-hmm. Who else?
John Goggins. I'm sure there were people that some of the lawyers in general counsel's office, but I don't know which ones would have been assigned to it.
How did this alleged violation become known to individuals at Moody's to spark this investigation?
As I recall, the Financial Times newspaper out of London received a tip, and I think maybe even some documentation, from an ex-employee who evidently had direct knowledge of it. And I do remember, although it was anonymous, Michael Caniff saying, we know who it is.
Did he say the name of the employee?
No.
Do you have any suspicion of the name of the employee?
No, because I wouldn't. Again, people at that level within structured finance, I wouldn't have had much interaction with.
What was Mr. Kernan's title or role in early 2008?
He was the head of structured finance. I believe his title would have been Executive Vice President, Structured Finance.
During your tenure, who do you recall served on ratings committees for RMBS CDOs?
I don't recall. I mean, my vice president for structured finance would have known that, but and I might have known some of the people on the team at the time, but with the passage of time, I don't remember specifically.
Now, you mentioned violations of professional conduct being under your purview. What groups within Moody's was responsible for policing or enforcing rules to ensure that there weren't any conflicts associated with ratings changes due to pressure from an issuer or underwriter?
Well, on one level, that would be compliance, because that's the type of thing that was meant to be covered by the Code of Professional Conduct. On another level, and I think a more day-to-day level, it's management, all the way up the chain for that particular line of business.
Did internal audit have any role in determining or reviewing the activities of the ratings committees?
Yes.
And what was the role of internal audit with respect to ratings committees?
Well, I didn't see a lot of their working papers, but as I recall, they would, for instance, check rating committee memos. It was very process-oriented. It was, did they follow the procedures? Is there a document where there ought to be a document? But they also looked at controls on a number of different issues. So their audit plan would include, you know, in the coming year, we're going to audit the following groups. And you knew if you were going to be audited that year, in fact. So the answer is yes, they were responsible for that.
And you mentioned Charles Chuck Windernet.
Windernet, yeah.
Windernet as being the head of internal control. And you indicated he was fired at what point in time was he fired? I didn't hear a date for that.
Sometime in 2007.
Who replaced him?
John Fitzpatrick. John was somebody who reported to Chuck, and so he was there on an interim basis. But it took almost a year to choose a replacement. So John was effectively the head of internal audit for a good part of the year.
And you'd indicated earlier that Mr. Windernet, that you were told Mr. Windernet was fired for not backing down. Who told you that?
Well, I wasn't told that he was fired for not backing down. I was told that he was fired, and I recall the general assumption, I guess is the best word, it's one of those things everybody knew. No, I think the way that I put it, and this is accurate, is nobody was surprised that he was fired because he had annoyed so many people at a senior level, like direct reports to Ray McDaniel, with the fact that he was writing these things. For instance, I heard it from my boss, Gene Deering, that that she was concerned and other people were concerned about the language he was using when he would write up anything that was a negative result.
What other employees were in internal audit? What other names of employees do you recall who would have been responsible for either RMBS CDOs or residential mortgage-backed securities ratings? Auditing those ratings.
Yeah. I don't think I would know who was assigned to various audits, and I'm trying to think if there are any other names within audit that I remember. I remember there was one, I just remember her first name was Lorraine. She was an auditor. She wasn't a manager.
And did you have, did internal audit report to you, or did you report to internal audit in any way?
No, we were at the same level.
Okay. And internal audit, did internal audit report directly to the audit committee of the board of directors?
I believe so. I'm not sure.
Now, in the letter that we received, our executive director at the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, Tom Green, received a letter from you on February 22nd, 2010. A letter was dated February 18th, 2010, from you to Mr. Green. First of all, did you write this letter to Tom Green?
Yes, I did. That's my signature on the letter.
Great. I want to ask you about a few references in the letter, if you don't mind. You had indicated in your letter, and you said, again, my experience bears out the need for such a provision since Moody's senior management actively excluded me from meetings with SEC staff during examinations, and the SEC inexplicably permitted Moody's to do so. Can you describe for me those meetings? When did they take place? Who was there from the SEC?
Sure.
And how exactly you were excluded?
The main one that I'm aware of was when the SEC came through to do what's known in the industry as a sweep examination. A sweep is where the SEC examines multiple firms for one particular issue. And this was right around the time, this would have been in 2000, and might have started in late 2007 and into 2008. They did a sweep examination of Moody's, Standard & Poor's, and Fitch. It's been well publicized. It's been discussed in Congress. And it was looking at rating of subprime mortgages. In my experience, and I think this most people in the industry would bear this out, it is highly, highly, highly unusual. I've never heard of it happening, that the SEC comes through in an examination and does not talk to the chief compliance officer. It's just unthinkable. And usually, you know, whenever I would go, I didn't do examinations, but I did, for instance, investigations where I'd wind up going to a firm, and chief compliance officer, if not the first person I'd talk to, it would be the somebody I talked to that first day. So I don't recall how I became aware that the examination was going on, but I did become aware. And the closest I got was when they first arrived, the SEC wanted to talk to people from various business lines to get background information, basically tell us how this department works. And one of the people they wanted to talk to evidently was me, but I'd already put in for a day off, and Michael Caniff said, we've scheduled it for whatever that day was. And I said, well, Michael, I'm scheduled to take a day off, but I'll reschedule it. Are you okay if I do it take my day off the following week? And he said, let me talk to John Goggins. And then later, I think the same day, Michael Caniff said, I talked to John. John said, no, Michael Caniff will represent compliance. Take your day off. And I think I reiterated, no, really, I can do this. And the answer was Michael Caniff would attend this. And because it was just the general get-to-know-you meeting, I wasn't too concerned about it at that point. But through the weeks and months that the examination continued, countless times, I couldn't even tell you how many times, I would go to Michael Caniff and say, what's going on with the examination? Is it even still going on? Because I haven't laid eyes on an SEC examiner the whole time. And Michael would say, yes, it's going on. And I would say, when do I get to talk to them? And I was told that various reasons. So sometimes I'd be told, yes, we'll get you in. Sometimes I'd be told, no, we... I, Michael Caniff, am there, and that's good enough. And, you know, I objected to it and was repeatedly told, I think more and more strenuously each time, that I was not going to participate in these meetings. So when I say that I was actively excluded, I made the point more than once, not just with SEC investigations, but also internal investigations when there were violations going on. I should be involved. I should be, you know, I am the person responsible when the SEC comes through. And I was repeatedly told, no, you're not going to participate.
Who from the SEC do you know was involved in that examination? That's
the only person I recall by name is Michael Macchiaroli, M as in Mike, A-C-C-H-I-A-R-O-L-I, I believe. And that's simply because I knew him. He was the person at the SEC responsible for leading the transition, if you will, consulting with the rating agencies as the regulations under 17G were developed. So that was a name I recognized. I think I did ask who else was involved, and I believe I heard that it was a multi-department team. There was one occasion where I, along with about five other people, met with four or five people from the SEC, but this was before, this was not in connection with any kind of a examination. So if anybody ever says, well, we remember him being at a meeting, this was when they were still going through the 17G writing process.
This was as part of the notice and comment period?
Exactly, yeah.
Okay.
So that's the only time I ever met with anybody from the SEC. During the examination itself, the answer to your question is Michael Macchiaroli. I don't know who else.
And subsequent to that exam sweep by the SEC sometime in late 07 or early 2008, did you have any occasion to talk to anyone from the SEC?
Never.
Did you ever approach the SEC for any reason?
After my departure.
And can you describe that?
Yes. About 6 months after my departure, so we're talking March of 2009, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote a letter to the SEC based on my concerns with respect to the monitoring of financial instruments in issued by public finance entities. My concerns stemmed from primarily a conversation I had in Michael Caniff's office in mid-2007. Sorry, do we have any water I could drink?
Yes.
Sorry, I just might be a little bit more...
why don't we take a very quick break?
Okay, good.
And
I'll hold the
record real quick. It is 3:15, and we're going to pause. It's 3:22 p.m. We're back on record. Mr. Borgers is on the line. Greg Feldberg has left. You were questioning Mr. Bondi?
Yes.
I was relating what had gone on with public institutions.
Mm-hmm.
You
wrote a letter. To whom did you write the letter at the SEC?
To Mike Macchiaroli.
Okay.
Yeah. In mid-2007, there was a meeting, Michael Caniff's office, attended by Michael Caniff, myself, and one of the people in the legal department, I don't remember which one it was, to discuss the problem that public finance, so municipal bonds primarily, weren't being monitored with respect to their ratings as thoroughly as, for instance, a corporate bond would be. And by surveillance, by monitoring, what I mean is once a bond is issued, it gets its rating when it's issued, but circumstances could very easily change. And so bonds are routinely monitored, basically take a look at it again and re-rate it and say it's maintained or it's got a new rating. The problem with public finance is that there are so many issuers. If you were to take a look at Moody's website, I think they say that they rate 26,000 different issuers, each of which may issue a number of different bonds. That's a hell of a lot of issuers and a lot of bonds. And in many cases, particularly the smaller issuers, don't go to the market every year, for instance. Now, the city of New York may, and so they're constantly looking at the finances of New York every time a new one comes out. But if you take a small school district in Iowa, for instance, it may only need to do a bond issue once every 5, 10, 20 years. And I remember when I first arrived at Moody's, and I was speaking with the leaders of the various business groups, questioning the head of the public finance, why is it, how often do you rate these things, and are you comfortable with the fact that these things aren't being rated? And I don't know whether the example that was thrown out to me was some of these things we haven't looked at in 20 years. But they weren't worried about it because they said finances of municipal bonds don't really change the way that the finances of a corporation will. Which I put on my list of things to be worried about, but not as high as other things because this was, you know, it sounded logical. But it was getting to be more and more of a problem because there had been in the news, and I think probably an awareness for other reasons within Moody's, that some municipalities were starting to have real problems. Not so, for a number of reasons. Number one is the economy is going down. Houses are going into foreclosure. People are out of jobs. Your revenues are going down. And just take a look at what was going on in the news then and is going on in the news now. Companies are shutting, or towns are shutting down schools, shutting down fire stations, furloughing personnel. And at some point, you could have one and then 10 and then 1,000 small towns out there making the decision, we can either put the public at risk, close down our schools, or we can just default on this bond. Now, if this bond has not been looked at in 5 years, it may still be carrying an investment grade rating. And the people that are holding this bond still think that this is an investment grade bond, and then one day it's worth nothing. Now, in the meantime, Moody's is saying on its website, when Ray McDaniel testifies to Congress, we monitor our ratings. Unless we specifically say this is a point-in-time rating. And the way I used to we would do point-in-time ratings on a fairly limited basis. And the way we used to describe it when talking about it internally was a point-in-time rating, when the rating letter ought to say, by the time you get to the bottom of this letter, this will be a stale rating, just to make it clear to people that this was a snapshot. They're not doing that. I don't know of a single instance with a public finance bond where they said this is a point-in-time rating. And so for Moody's to come out and say to the public, we monitor ratings, you know, they can be clever and try to split hairs and say, well, we monitor them once every 20 years, or we have a system where if we become aware of a problem, if there's some sort of alert generated, we look at it. But the investing public is going to read that and think, when I buy a bond rated by Moody's, any bond, it is being monitored. And somebody there is saying this single A rating is still valid. And that's not the case. And it cannot be the case. I'll give you an example. I mentioned, I went into some detail with respect to what I did for the NASD the first time I worked there. I was in market surveillance, looking at, primarily looking for market manipulation. You have the same situation there. You've got a very large universe of things to look at, and you cannot look at everyone every minute of every day. So you set up an alert system, and you establish parameters. You say, if a stock moves more than X percent in 1 day, 10 days, 60 days, accompanied by a jump in volume of whatever, then generate an alert. The alert goes to an analyst, and an analyst will start looking at that and say, well, there's a reason for it, news came out, or this looks suspicious, I'm going to open an investigation. That's what I did. And from doing that for years, I became familiar with how you would need to do this. The first thing you need to do is you need to identify what your parameters are that you're going to feed in and say, look at this. Look at the price and look at the volume. That's pretty straightforward for a stock. I don't know what kind of measurable, frequently reported parameters you would have for a municipal entity. Even if you could, things that were going on, you would never know. For instance, Jefferson County, Alabama, I think it was, buying a boatload of derivatives that they didn't realize how toxic they were. I guarantee you, if there's anybody else out there that's doing the same thing in the municipality, if Moody's knows about it, they know about it by accident, not because there was some parameter that broke. So you have to have the right parameters. Then you have to set your parameters correctly. So you could say, I want, going back to the stock analogy, I want an alert every time something moves more than 5% in a day, because I want to catch everything. And so you're going to wind up with a ton of alerts. And you're going to have enough people to actually work through all those alerts. That means that you've got to adjust your parameters so that you get all of the potential violations without overwhelming people. And what tends to happen, what can happen, is you start to get a lot of alerts and you say, well, I can't hire more people, so let's just narrow the alerts. And now you're getting fewer hits. So you've not only, if you're going to try to monitor for municipals, to know when you should actually review something, you've got to decide with precision what factors you're going to look at, and then you've got to set the parameters correctly. So this is getting to be a problem within Moody's. They're thinking we need to do something so that we can actually monitor the ratings on municipal securities. And in this meeting I mentioned, Michael Caniff and myself and one or two other people present, it starts off with Michael Caniff saying, just as a reminder, and I'm paraphrasing, just as a reminder, John Goggins wanted me to repeat that nothing about this goes in writing. No emails. Well, I'm paraphrasing, but the parts that were definitely there were not in writing, no emails, and this is from John Goggins. And it came from Michael Caniff's lips. Now, this was not the first time that I had heard either explicitly or implicitly, don't put this in writing. But under the circumstances, and given the fact that I was already more and more concerned about the situation at Moody's, this one really stuck in my memory.
Who else was present, do you remember?
Michael Caniff, and there was an attorney from the general counsel's office, but I don't remember who it was. It was probably one of two or three people. Jessica Lieberman, L-I-B as in boy, E-R-M-A-N, or I'll have to get back to you with the other names. I can picture faces, but I can't remember their names.
And the meeting took place in Mr. Caniff's office?
In Mr. Caniff's office.
And when did you say the date of that meeting was?
It was roughly mid-2008, a couple months before my departure.
Did you have any other similar concerns with respect to the monitoring of residential mortgage-backed securities or CDOs with RMBS as the underlying collateral?
To the extent that anything came up in structured finance, I think that it was more interpretation, should we call something, should we make something point in time or not? They usually dealt with new situations or a new type of instrument or arrangement. So I think to your point, structured finance or residential mortgage-backed securities in general, was there a concern? I don't remember having one brought to me.
Would your group, would compliance have been responsible for ensuring that the appropriate level of monitoring occurred if a deal was to be monitored?
We were involved in that, but there were other groups that were involved, and ultimately there were set up for each of the groups, I don't remember what they were called, monitoring units or surveillance units. And that was the upshot of, incidentally, the meeting with Michael Caniff, was the creation of a specific unit to monitor municipal ratings. And one thing that I recall, and again, my memory has just failed me, but there, what struck me was somebody actually did put an email out there, and it was the person responsible for setting up this unit. I don't remember who it was. I remember it was a fairly senior female person, and I believe it. What I remember is they were fairly senior, they were female, and they were somebody that I respected as somebody who was concerned about compliance, but I couldn't tell you now who it was. But sometime in mid-2008, this person sent an email saying that they were concerned that they didn't have sufficient staffing to do all that was going to be required.
The monitoring unit, though, that was set up following your meeting with Michael Caniff in mid-2008, was that devoted just, though, to municipal securities, or were there other monitoring units that subsequently were set up for RMBS and CDOs, or did those units already exist?
They already existed.
Okay. Do you recall who was part of the monitoring unit during your tenure for RMBS CDOs?
No.
What about RMBS?
No, I don't recall who was responsible for any of the monitoring units at this stage. Too much time has passed.
Have there been allegations in general about rating agencies and the so-called revolving door, where employees leave a group and then go to work for, say, an investment bank with whom the employee had previously dealt? Were there any instances, to your knowledge, of any employees leaving Moody's to go work for investment banks that they had previously interacted with?
None that I recall. However, at some point in 2008, we started looking at how we would address that, and we started to institute look-back procedures. And actually, now that I think about it, I think that might have been sparked by an analyst leaving and going somewhere, and somebody saying we should do a look-back. But I don't remember who it was.
Do you remember where the analyst went?
No.
Remember what product line it was?
Let me think for a second. I'm not 100% sure, but I think the product line was financial institutions. It was somebody rating financial institutions, not structured finance, but the financial institutions group.
During the course of 2007 and 2008, there were a series of downgrades by Moody's of RMBS and CDOs containing RMBS. Do you have any knowledge or information relating to any of those downgrades?
No, not. The only thing that I would have been involved in might have been making sure that it was announced and put out on our website promptly. I was involved more deeply with the downgrades of the monoline insurers because we needed to set up a group that was going to be reviewing these, and it was a fairly large group, and so we had to put them on a series of special restrictions with respect to their trading. We just had to basically say you can't trade anything, and also making sure that we had to put out a special banner on our website that I reviewed, but I didn't create, that basically told people, well, here was the problem with downgrading the monolines. When you downgrade, a monoline is an insurer that used to only insure municipal securities, of all things. The problem was that they also decided they were going to buy credit default swaps and other toxic assets, which undermined their credit worthiness. Now, if the whole business model behind a monoline insurer is they have a AAA rating, so if you're a municipality and you're only getting a BBB rating, you want to buy insurance, bond insurance from a monoline. That way your bond will now have a AAA rating. In fact, when I was a stockbroker, that's what I always looked for. And I still recall telling my clients, don't worry, if this thing defaults, it's insured. So everything hangs on the creditworthiness of a monoline. When Moody's, to its credit, said we need to downgrade these things, what that meant was they then, suppose you just downgrade one, AMBAC, A-M-B-A-C, you've got to go now and identify every bond out there that AMBAC has been rated, because now if AMBAC had a AAA rating, now it's got a single A. Now all those things have a AAA rating, and there are even some instances where a municipality wound up with a higher rating than the monoline insurer. And there were about, I don't know, six monolines that were all under review and eventually downgraded. So that was a lot of work. And the reason why we needed to put up this banner was to tell the world, we're still trying to figure out exactly who this affects. But if you've got a security that was probably insured by a monoline, it's probably going to be affected. Watch this space. We'll put out more information. So that was the effect. That was the extent of my involvement on monolines.
And the six monolines, for the record, would they have been AIG, MBIA, AMBAC, and who were the other three?
I don't believe AIG was a monoline. I think FGIC, Foxtrot, Gulf, India, Charlie, I think is one. I mean, AMBAC and MBIA are the ones that are commonly known.
Okay.
I don't remember the others, but I don't believe that AIG... I could be wrong.
Okay. Now, focusing, though, on MBIA and AMBAC and what you've described as the monoline insurers, you mentioned that there was a group set up. When was that group set up?
2000. Certainly in 2008. It might have been, I want to say it was December 2007, because I just seem to remember it overlapping the Christmas season, but certainly it was in 2008.
Who was part of the group?
Well, the leader was Laura, L-A-U-R-A, Levenstein, L-E-V as in Victor, E-N as in November, S-T-E-I-N.
Mm-hmm. Who else do you recall being in that group?
There were literally dozens of people at all different levels. I mean, even IT people.
Were you in that group?
I wasn't in the group in the sense that I was doing work on it, but I was in the group in that I had to be involved in all major decisions. And I will say this, Laura Levenstein is one of the people that I alluded to earlier that really takes compliance seriously. And so, you know, if there was any reason to question whether we should lift a restriction on somebody or whether or not to extend this ban on trading, she always took a very compliance-friendly line.
So. Now, some in the in commentators have criticized the rating agencies for not downgrading the model lines like MBIA and AMBAC sooner.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know if there was any discussions of downgrades that occurred much earlier in time than the actual downgrade occurred?
Not much earlier in time. Like anything else, this is something where it starts off with a few conversations and then a decision is made. But I don't recall any substantive discussions on this more than a week or two out, but I wouldn't necessarily expect to be involved in those in the early stages.
Do you know of any allegations or of any intentional delays and downgrades associated with the monoline insurers?
No, I don't.
What about any, do you know of any allegations of any intentional delays in any downgrades that Moody's did?
I'm thinking, no, I don't remember any.
And I mentioned earlier AIG. Was a similar committee or group set up around the downgrade of AIG?
Not to my recollection.
Okay. Do you know who would have been responsible for the downgrade of AIG?
I'm sure I knew at the time, but I don't remember now.
Did you have any dealings yourself with Countrywide?
No.
Do you know of any instances where Countrywide may have received a higher rating because it was a repeat customer of Moody's?
I don't know. In fact, I don't remember them showing up on our list that we had to create of our top 10 customers. We were required under 17G to create one.
Who were your top customers, if you recall?
Deutsche Bank was number one. Mostly the big investment banks. Countrywide could have been on there. I don't know. They could have been bankrupt by that point. But it doesn't strike me as... I don't recall where I sat hearing of Countrywide is you know, a sensitive issue.
Were the 17G, was that an annual thing?
It is, yeah. Well, it was... first, we had to do it to essentially reapply for NRSRO status in the summer of 2007 and annually thereafter. In fact, they just would have filed. It's required to be filed within 3 months of the end of each calendar year. So essentially, a new one has to be done, has to be filed by March the 31st. And just as a little bit of a sidelight, but it could be significant, I've always been surprised. I haven't seen the one that they would have just filed. But one of the things that you're required to file publicly, not everything in the form NRSRO is public. One of the things you're supposed to file as one of the attachments is a list of the policies through which you protect material non-public information, and I think a separate annex for how you prevent conflicts of interest. The whole point of the separation policy that I was working on and was virtually ready to go when I was kicked out was to manage conflicts of interest. I think somebody told me after I left that almost a year after I left, it was finally implemented. I have no idea what it looks like or what they were doing with it during that year. But I checked their last filed NRSRO, and it's not even listed there. And I don't know whether that's just the current CCO doesn't know what he's doing or whether they don't view that this is an important policy for managing conflicts of interest. But because it's not up there, I can't look at it and make any determination based on my own experience whether they have effective policies and procedures in place. But I'm sorry, I took you off on a tangent.
Are you aware of any not immaterial non-public information being communicated to Warren Buffett, one of the investors of Moody's?
No, I'm not.
Are you aware of any conversations that anyone at Moody's had with S&P or Fitch concerning downgrades or rating correlation or cooperation in downgrades or ratings?
I'm not, and the only thing I'll say on that subject is that it was a from the very beginning there was concern over any appearance of collusion. And early on, I think even in my job interview, I mentioned if I get this job as the CCO, the Chief Compliance Officer, I ought to probably be talking to the CCOs at Standard & Poor's and Fitch, because you don't compete on compliance. And it's not to ask things like, hey, what did the SEC ask you, but to find out, hey, what systems are you using, what works, what doesn't work. And John Goggins said, no contact whatsoever. So I would be very surprised to hear, well, nothing surprises me these days about Moody's, but it would have been uncharacteristic to hear that somebody had reached out. But, of course, the nature of what you're talking about is somebody who knows that they're violating the rules anyway, so I don't think they'd be too concerned about violating a Moody's policy if that were the case. But to answer your question, I have no knowledge.
Was there a gift policy with respect to analysts and business personnel dealing with issuers and underwriters?
Yes, there was.
Do you recall the gift policy?
I believe it was you could not accept anything more than $50. It was pretty standard.
Were there any violations of that gift policy during your tenure?
Not that I'm aware of, although I would have been, I would have said no to skydiving with issuers, which is what I understand Brian Clarkson did. While you're looking through your notes, I just wanted to kind of close the loop on the letter to the SEC. The reason why I eventually sent it was, upon my departure, something was underway. It was, by all accounts, going to be under-resourced. But following the news after my departure, I became more and more concerned about what was happening economically and the impact it was having on municipals. And so at that point, I didn't at the time, and if you actually read the letter, I don't consider it a whistleblowing thing. I'd love to take credit for that, but really what I was saying in the letter was the SEC had not yet come through and done any annual examinations of Moody's, and as far as I know, they still haven't, which is a big problem. Doing a sweep, you look at one issue. To look at everything, you need to do a routine examination. So I told them in the letter to Mr. Macchiaroli, when you start writing the modules, the routine through which you will examine a credit rating agency, make sure you look at municipal surveillance, because they're telling the world that we surveil, we monitor all ratings, unless we say it's a point-in-time rating. And I said, for the following reasons, that is not the case. And I said, I was told, I know it's a problem when they tell me not to write it down. And the reason why I wrote it at that point in time in March is simply I was getting concerned that there could be a wave of defaults as these municipalities, large and small, decide that it's in their residents, taxpayers' interest to default on a bond rather than continue to make cuts that are going to be very serious. Obviously, that has not happened yet, and hopefully it won't in the future. But the problem is that municipal securities don't just affect municipal securities. They're held by pension funds. They're held by other municipalities. It could be another trigger that works like a credit default swap where it permeates the rest of the system. Now, about a month after I sent this to the SEC, and I think it's a coincidence, Moody's put out a blanket announcement. We are putting the entire municipal, U.S. municipal debt sector, I believe it was on watch, which is basically saying we're looking at something, stand by for more news. And you do that to avoid surprising the market. And you do it usually on a bond-by-bond basis. I've never heard of an entire sector. But it's meaningless, because if you hold any municipal, you don't know whether my AAA bond issued by Washington, D.C. is actually good, or if it's one that is hollowed out from the inside. And so it was really something, my suspicion is this came from John Goggins saying, we've got to cover ourselves. In case we're sued, we can say, well, we put it on watch. So I think that was a bit of a coincidence, but I never did hear from the SEC. I've heard rumors that they did come in and do an examination, but I have to tell you, having done investigations for as many years as I did, I can't imagine them. I understand that I wouldn't go back to the complainant and say, here's the status of the investigation, but I would go back to the original source just to find out, what else do you know? Has anything changed? And to this day, number one, I've never been contacted by the SEC. Number two, I haven't seen anything come out of Moody's that seems to indicate that they're addressing the problem. So,
were you ever consulted on any complaints that were expressed by market participants such as Vanguard, Fortis, BlackRock, and PIMCO with respect to the quality of ratings?
I was aware that BlackRock and I believe PIMCO had expressed concerns. I was not consulted on them. And at this point, I couldn't tell you whether I was aware from an internal source or from reading it in the newspaper.
I've seen some references to a subprime group or a subprime task force. What was that?
I don't think I don't want to say I don't have a recollection, but I don't think I know what that is.
There's some names I wanted to ask you about if you knew these people and if you had any interaction with them.
Sure.
Gary Witt?
Yes.
And who is he and what was your interaction?
Gary was, I believe, a managing director who was responsible. I think he'd held different positions over time. He was very well regarded. He set up a new unit that was looking at, I think it was operational risk, is what we were calling it with respect to hedge funds. And essentially, it was providing ratings of a sort, let's just say kind of quick evaluations of the intangible risks associated with a particular hedge fund manager. So what's the quality of their management? What's their experience? And it was meant to be a piece of information that an investor could use when deciding whether to do business with a hedge fund. Gary was one of those people that if I wrinkled my brow when he was telling me something, he would back off and say, we won't do it. So he was very compliance-oriented. He left to go teach at one of the Philadelphia universities.
Temple,
yeah.
You still keep in contact with him?
No, but he's a good guy.
We may have mentioned this name earlier, and forgive me if we have. Mark
Almeida.
Almeida?
Yes.
Who was Mark Almeida, and what did he do?
Mark Almeida was the head of Moody's Analytics. So when they created this organization, just to reiterate, you had Moody's Investor Service, which was the ratings business, Moody's Analytics, which was all the other types of business. And as such, a lot of the commercial interests, if you will, were reporting to him, and most of the people that pushed back, specifically with respect to the separation policy, reported to him, and from their comments, my view was that he was driving the resistance to anything that would curtail the commercial aspects of the business, and specifically my insistence on separating their contact with the ratings analysts.
Mary Elizabeth Brennan?
The name is vaguely familiar, but I couldn't tell you anything more about her.
David Little?
Again, vaguely familiar.
Steve Tulenko?
Steve Tulenko, yeah. I believe he was Eric Kolchinski's boss after Eric was moved out of structured finance. He worked in one of the units that fell within Moody's Analytics, I believe, but I couldn't tell you which unit it was. I got the general feeling that he was a pretty good guy with respect to compliance.
And what was your view, or what is your view of Eric Kolchinski?
Good guy. I'll tell you exactly what I felt when I saw in the papers that he was going to testify to Congress. The story that was printed was that he had gone to my successor. Actually, I think he had gone to Michael Caniff. This was after my departure. With concerns about what was going on in structured finance and specifically with respect to ratings. What went through my mind was that once or twice during my tenure there, somebody would come in and you have to decide, as any investigator does, is this person bearing a grudge? Are they interpreting things in a way that's, you know, favorable to them? You know, is this worth listening to or not? And the first thing that struck my mind when I read that Eric Kolchinsky had gone to Michael Caniff was, if Eric Kolchinsky had come to me with anything, I would have sat up and listened, because this guy knew his stuff. He was somebody who believed in compliance, and I had already had enormous respect for him. The other thing I'll say, which is probably less relevant, is that, you know, I said I don't consider myself a whistleblower. I didn't, you know, other than writing the letter to the SEC, I didn't come forward and put my head above the parapet, if you will, until a year later when I was asked to testify to Congress. Eric Kolchinsky put in writing the problems that he saw after Michael Caniff did nothing about it. I have absolutely no doubt that he knew when he put that in writing, he was signing his Moody's death certificate. To voluntarily raise an issue knowing it's going to put you into the worst employment market in a generation, that takes a lot of guts. And he knows the stuff, he knows the models better than most people in Moody's, and you know, for him to raise the issues that he did, I take everything he says as smoking hot gospel.
Mark McKenna?
Vaguely familiar, but I couldn't tell you more.
We may have mentioned her name earlier. Michelle Adler?
You didn't mention earlier. She had various roles. I think one had to do, I think she was responsible at one point for what I'm going to call issuer relations, just acting kind of as the liaison between issuers and Moody's. But that's all I recall at this point.
Like in a commercial sense, a salesperson, or just more talking to them if they have questions?
I wouldn't call it so much sales as account management. In other words, dealing with existing customers.
Mary Lovett, L-O-V-A-T-T.
Doesn't ring a bell.
Who are the other people in the similar position of Mr. Kolchinsky that you think we ought to interview?
Well, I mentioned Jerry Fons.
Mm-hmm.
I would try to talk to Chuck Windenecht. I don't have contact information for him. I have not been in touch with him.
Do you know where he lives or what he does now?
I don't. He might be on LinkedIn, but he doesn't have a very common name, so he might be easier to track down. John Fitzpatrick, who was Chuck Windenecht's replacement, interim replacement, I should say, but, I mean, for the better part of a year. And John was another person that was, he was very good about compliance, and I think that he should have stayed there. He should have been allowed to take that position permanently, but I think he was just considered too junior.
Where's Mr. Fitzpatrick now?
I don't know. I think I've got some contact information. I'll look and see.
Now, you mentioned your letter to the SEC. I believe I've seen that publicly. Maybe I'm confusing that with another letter. But do you have a copy of that?
The letter to the SEC?
Mm-hmm.
I saw that earlier.
Is that posted on the House?
It's on the Internet. The only reason I'm hesitating is I had a hard drive get wiped out.
Sure.
But, I mean, if I needed to get it to you, I'd just pull it off the Internet.
I
read that, and I was looking for it on here.
Thought I'd seen it somewhere as well. And
I don't think it's in here.
Okay.
I'll find it.
And
what was your interaction with Richard Cantor?
It was occasional. I thought he was a good guy. I thought, you know, for him to be put up to testify in defense of Moody's at the House panel that Eric Kolchinsky and I testified to was simply pushing in front of Congress somebody who could legitimately say he had no knowledge of the things that they wanted to know about. I thought Richard was a decent guy. I didn't have enough interaction with him to form a strong opinion one way or the other. But I just thought that they pushed him in front of Congress to take the hits because the real question, the people they should have been asking these questions to were John Goggins, Michael Caniff, and Ray McDaniel.
And Brian Clarkson.
And Brian Clarkson, yes.
Do you have contact information for Brian Clarkson by any chance?
No, I don't.
We have, by statute, subpoena power.
Right.
We can get documents from Moody's. We can get documents from third parties. We can get documents from regulators and such. We're obviously investigating the rating agencies and in particular Moody's and how they went about their ratings. What sort of documents, if you were in our position, would you be asking for?
Well, I think it was alluded to earlier, there was a recent article about the board, and it just makes me think that I would get all the board minutes and all the board reports that were submitted to them. I mean, certainly the entire time I was there, and you know, pick your time period. I would subpoena all of the documents prepared for the risk management committee meetings, because among the 31 risks, some of them dealt with the risk of getting things wrong on subprime.
Was the risk management committee a committee of the board, or is this a management committee you're referring to?
Well, it was a management committee. I don't believe it. Well, yeah, it was made up of people from Moody's, and they were the people that sent the report or didn't send the report to the board. This is the one that was headed by Chester Murray.
Hmm. Was Chester Murray the chief risk officer, though? Or
no,
who was the chief risk officer?
Well, there wasn't a chief risk officer, at least not at the time. Chester Murray was the EVP for International, and one of his additional duties was head of the risk management committee, although, as I said, I think on paper Ray was. So that was just his additional duty. There were two people that were permanent staff for risk management: Carlton Charles and Kevin Valentine. I believe Carlton Charles is still there. Kevin Valentine, I believe, has moved on, but I don't have any contact.
They were permanent staff for this committee?
Well, I wouldn't say permanent staff for the committee. They were, well, let me put it this way. I never saw them do anything else.
Okay.
Kevin Valentine was the person who would send you an email once every quarter saying, don't forget you've got to do these, produce these papers by the meeting the day after tomorrow, and we would all grumble about, gee, I wish you'd given me a week's worth of notice, but it should have been in our calendars anyway. So he was kind of I don't want to paint a picture that he was lower than he was, but he was kind of the administrative person. Hmm. Carlton Charles, I don't know what he did, but Kevin Valentine reported to Carlton. And I believe he was, to the extent that there was a head of risk management, that was Carlton, but Carlton was not senior by any means.
Okay. Is there a particular meeting or meetings or time frame of the risk management committee we should focus on?
I would focus on the period, I would focus on all of 2007, all of 2008. And I would subpoena, among other things, a list of the 31 risks, including those that were identified as major risks. And that will point you in the direction of which specific ones to go after, because as I said, there were some that I wouldn't be able to articulate here and now that spoke to the risk of structured finance. Beyond that, things to subpoena, I mean, I think the obvious that you've probably thought about, you know, emails dealing with all of those issues, emails dealing with the issue that I raised with respect to monitoring Municipal Securities. Any emails regarding the dismissal of Joe Alotto, regarding the dismissal of Scott Morrow, regarding the dismissal of me, and also regarding the reassignment of David Teicher. Because about, I want to say, 9 months after they gave him the job, he was essentially demoted and made a project manager within his own department. And they brought in somebody who, I guess, had some compliance experience, hadn't been a CCO, but had been, I think, a legal counsel in the compliance department. I think he'd actually been with the Department of Justice as well. My reaction to that is, that's great, but that just brings them back to where they were on September 3rd, 2008, before they fired me. As long as you have the same reporting lines, which they still do, nothing's going to change.
I've heard that Ryan Clarkson didn't use email. Is that true? Or he wasn't a prolific email writer?
I got a few emails from him. It's true, he was not a prolific email writer, and John Goggins, I would be surprised if he put anything in writing ever.
Did Mr. Clarkson have an executive assistant or a chief of staff or a secretary that would send reports for him or do things for him?
Yes, he had an administrative assistant. And
what was his or her name?
It was a her, but I don't remember, and frankly, I'm not sure I will remember.
What about a chief of staff or anything like that?
No.
Or a deputy?
Deputy probably would have been, well, he didn't have a deputy per se, but I would say probably Noel Kernan. Michael Caniff reported to him directly until he became my boss as well.
Is there anything else you think we ought to know about either your experience at Moody's or anything else relating to rating agencies in general?
Sure. A couple things. One, I just wanted to mention as a... we had talked about the problem of the issuer pays model. I did want to just mention that one thing that Moody's did while I was there, and I believe that they're continuing to do, was to come up with a policy with respect to ensuring that you don't have the same people making rating decisions and also negotiating fees with customers. And it's like everything else in a rating agency. The more you try to put something simple down, and there's five different people that need exceptions and whatever. So it was getting a little bit involved. But I just wanted to come back to that point about you had asked about anything we did with respect to the issuer pays model, and that was something that was specifically instituted. Beyond that, I think just generally, a couple things. One is, and I know you're looking more backwards rather than forwards, but one thing that concerns me is talk that I've seen coming out of the SEC and the and Congress about the possibility of just removing any reference to NRSRO ratings. In my view, having been in compliance in an NRSRO, that would be a big mistake the way that it's written right now, because if there's no point to being an NRSRO, if there's no obligation to have that status for statutory reasons, they're all going to deregister. And if they're not NRSROs anymore, they're not regulated anymore. And so now you'd have a situation where you've got the rating agencies totally unregulated, and I think nobody wants that. In the meantime, I don't think they'd lose any business. People don't go to Moody's and S&P because they're NRSROs. They go to them because they're Moody's and S&P. So you'd wind up cutting off your nose without even spiting your face. So there's that, you know, just from where I sat, that we had not enough oversight from the SEC, but you'd lose what little there was. With respect to not enough oversight from the SEC, we covered that that I was excluded by Moody's, but it was also surprising to me that the SEC didn't push Michael Caniff aside and say, we want to speak to McCleskey. And the reason for that is this. If you look at the legislative history of the Credit Rating Agency Reform Act and the development of 17G, which implemented it, there is one position required by law for a credit rating agency to have. It's not analyst. It's not CEO. It's head of compliance. The statutorily designated compliance officer is the way they designate it. And if you look at the legislative history, there's a lot of stuff written there by Congress and by the SEC saying, this is why this position is so important. There's, it's very, they state in writing that the whole point is that this is going to be the person who's responsible for making sure everything that we, Congress, and we, the SEC, expect to be done gets done. They explain why it's important that there be, as part of the form NRSRO, the background and education of the compliance officer. And they say it's because it's important that this person has the authority, has the experience, and has the independence to do their jobs. So the commissioner, the five commissions, five commissioners, they sign off on this. They say this is an important thing. Congress has said this. Now you have a situation where somebody, let's just be charitable and say a few levels below the commissioners, come into Moody's and don't insist on seeing that designated compliance officer. That just undercut everything that's in the law and in 17G. And I'm sure the situation was that Michael Caniff was presented as the head of compliance because he was the head of that department and another department. But all it would have taken was for somebody to take a look at the filed form NRSRO and say, well, then who is Scott McCleskey? And then once they got their answer, and particularly if they found out Michael Caniff used to be in structured finance, I just feel that the SEC really did everybody a disservice by accepting, by letting Moody's blow smoke at them the way that Bernard Madoff did. And that's why in the letter and in some other things that I've put out to the public, I think that it's just two things are important. One is reinforcing the independence and authority of the compliance officer. And it's not good enough just to say they should report to the board. Because strictly speaking, I reported to the board once a year in a written report which had been vetted and edited by three levels of management. And yes, I got to present it to the board and the board asked no questions. What I'm talking about is that the board has sole authority to hire, fire, and compensate the chief compliance officer and to determine the compliance budget. That's the kind of independence that's needed, backed by a robust regulatory framework in fixing the level of experience and training of the SEC and other regulators. Would take another day of testimony, but it's something that I've put some views out there to the public as well.
Aside from the SEC, did you have any interactions with any other regulators?
No.
And aside from your testimony to the Hill, have you given any other testimony or interviews by any other government entities?
I've been interviewed by the Connecticut State Attorney General had a conference call, and the Department of Justice.
Who at the Department of Justice?
It was the Civil Division. I believe his last name was Graber.
And the Connecticut AG, would that have been George O'Neill by any chance?
It might have been. I can't remember. It was some time ago.
We may, in the future, hold a hearing on credit rating agencies. If we do, would you be willing to testify?
Yeah.
A couple other questions, and I think we've covered a lot, but one was there have been allegations that some credit rating agencies may have intimidated the analysts or the quants, the folks that were behind the models. Do you know of any instances at Moody's where individuals responsible for the models were either intimidated into changing a model or forced out of Moody's? Any instances along those lines?
The only one that I can think of is the one that was made public and that I alluded to earlier as leading to Noel Kernan, possibly leading to Noel Kernan's resignation. And I say possibly because there were a couple of different instances around the same time, and I don't remember which one was which. But there was an instance where there was a model that apparently had a flaw that led to the wrong rating, and there was pressure. I want to make sure I say this right. I think the problem was the methodology, which is the way the things that you look at and how you look at them, and a change was made to the model to so that the outcome wouldn't be different. I'm probably characterizing that a little bit incorrectly, but it's out there in the newspaper, so that's the incident that I'm talking about. Other than that, other than what's been made public, I do not.
Other than what may have been reported in the press or in the public, do you know of any misconduct or alleged misconduct at any of the other rating agencies?
No.
And we covered the question of any testimony with regulators or interviews with regulators. Have you been interviewed or given testimony in any civil actions?
I've been interviewed by people involved in two civil actions. One is the people representing CalPERS. I'm trying to remember. The other group, I think, was representing, I want to say it was one of the Federal Reserve Banks. I think Chicago.
Do you remember the law firms or lawyers' names?
No, I don't. I could probably find them, though.
If you could, that might be helpful. Okay. And the names, we've mentioned several names. If you have contact information for any of the former
employees. I'll follow up with an email.
Okay, that's good.
All right.
That'd be great. Go ahead.
Mr.
McClellan? Yeah.
This is Tom Borgers. I just have a few quick questions.
Sure.
My associate definitely did cover everything, although I have a couple quick ones. As far as, do you all have cell phones when you're at the, that were given to you by Moody's?
Yes, we had BlackBerries that had cell phone capability.
Okay, and a couple other quick questions. You've heard of Bill Ackman of Pershing Square, formerly of Gotham, who was focused on the monoline insurers over the last 8 years.
I'm not familiar with him.
Oh, how about David Einhorn with his short position on Moody's?
I'm not familiar with that either. I think it's a good idea.
One question we didn't ask, and I apologize, is the downgrade of Lehman. Were you involved or consulted on the downgrade of Lehman prior to its bankruptcy?
Not consulted. I don't believe I was informed. There was, with respect to Bear Stearns, however, in fact, I should point out, Lehman's actually went bankrupt a week after my departure. But on Bear Stearns, there was a person who came in and made a complaint to me, and with the passage of 2 or 3 years, maybe a little bit sketchy on the details, but she was responsible for, she wasn't a rating analyst, but she provided input. She was a kind of a specialist on corporate governance. And her allegation was that she had been making attempts to get corporate governance included as a negative factor at Bear Stearns into their rating for the 6 months or so prior to Bear Stearns' collapse. and she felt that there were violations to the Code of Professional Conduct in the fact that it wasn't being reflected in the rating.
What was her name?
I don't remember.
She was a Moody's employee?
She was a Moody's employee. And she was fired at the end of 2007. I was told that that dismissal was, there were many people fired in one big layoff at the end of 2007. I was told that that was the reason. My recollection is that whenever we got one of these complaints, we only had a handful. We worked them jointly either with human resources or legal. It wasn't something I would have looked at directly. I would have delegated it to one of my staff. But I recall that her allegation seemed a bit, after it was looked into, it looked a bit not well-founded. But so there was something with respect to Bear Stearns, but no, not with respect to Lehman.
Is there anything else outside of Moody's that we should be looking at that you haven't addressed yet?
Let me think about that for a second. Well, I've raised my concerns, obviously, about the regulators, both with respect to Moody's and just more generally. No, I think that's everything.
Are you aware of any concerns with respect to Goldman Sachs, or specifically Goldman Sachs CDOs, synthetic CDOs?
Not specifically, no.
Okay. What about generally? Were there any concerns with respect to Goldman Sachs and Moody's?
None that I recall, no.
You had mentioned a woman named Farisa Zarin.
Yeah.
Was she in charge of compliance when you started, or I'm not clear?
Yeah. Before my arrival, Farisa Zarin was responsible for regulatory affairs and compliance. So regulatory affairs included interacting with the SEC, with European regulators, with all regulators with respect to at that time, the potential regulations and laws. So acting, you know, basically interacting with policymakers, regulators, lobbying in many cases. And she was also responsible for compliance. And so when I arrived, she split off the compliance function. She gave that to me. She and I were presumably at the same level. And then we just did the duties differently. At some point, she was promoted to team managing director, which is, in terms of titles, that was one level above me. I will say this, that with respect to the amount of management attention given to compliance and regulatory affairs, we had adjacent offices. John Goggins, who was Michael Caniff's boss, two levels above Farisa, two levels above me, spent a lot of time talking with Farisa in her office virtually every day. You'd walk in there and they're just sitting around shooting the bull or whatever, because he really enjoyed the whole political aspect. In fact, the one time that I actually got in to see him and I was raising concerns over a conflict of interest, he kept coming back to the political aspect of it, and I had to keep bringing him back to know this is a conflict of interest. And it just illustrates that the fact that the focus was on lobbying and on litigation. John Goggins, even though he was in the adjacent office, not once, and I'm not exaggerating, never once stepped into my office. Never once even in the hallway said, what's going on in compliance? But he was very, very keen to know what was going on in the lobbying role.
When did she leave the company?
She's still there.
Oh, she's still there.
Yeah.
Do you have any idea what the budget size were for lobbying for regulatory affairs?
Actually, I looked it up on a website. I think it was about
$800,000.
Okay. Yeah.
Was there an outside lobbyist that Moody's used, went to? Probably more than one, perhaps.
Yeah. Well, I know that they had various relationships with law firms. In fact, for some reason, some of that moved through my budget. Every time I had to do the budget recap, I'd go to the finance people and say, why is there a legal expense on my budget? And they'd say, well, that's John Goggins. I never saw the invoices. I don't know what it was for.
Is Goggins still at the company?
Oh, yeah. You know, as long as Goggins and Caniff are there and in the positions they're in, I think that Moody's is still going to have a problem. And to that extent, we're not talking about past history. We're talking about the present and the future.
Could I ask, you seem, well, you pretty much stated that Moody's wanted to keep you away from the SEC bidders. Did you ever get the sense that they wanted to keep you away from people internally?
Maybe the board, but I'm not sure. Are you specific about a particular group?
Well, no, I'm just, was your background with the FBI well known?
Yes.
Yeah. I'm good. We're good to go off record. It's 4:33. Before I go off record, I'd just like to caution you that everything that comes before the commission, we request that you keep it confidential and not discuss topics brought up here, questions that we pose to you and whatnot.
Okay. Yeah, with respect to contacting people, I suppose I'll just give you their contact information and
right.
You'll contact them directly.
Right.
Okay.
All right. It's 4:33. We're going to go off record.